Good morning, everyone. We're going to begin the land use meeting. Before we do, I just wanted to thank the Miami Classical Music Festival, who are here, and I know you enjoyed the beautiful music as you were coming in. We have Li Zhengqian on. She played the viola. Li Zheng is from the Mann School of Music in New York, and we had Zachary Foster on the cello. And Zachary is from the Boston Conservatory, very fine musicians. Miami Beach is the happy new home of the Miami Classical Music Festival. They have one more week here in the city of Miami Beach, so hopefully you'll go to miamimusicfestival.com and look at their last remaining performance schedule. Again, thank you to the Betsy Hotel for hosting them, and the South Beach Hotel Group for hosting them and helping make it possible for Miami Beach. We are their new home permanently, so we will again next summer have more than 300 classically trained artists here all summer performing, and just thank them for coming, welcome them to the family. Yes, a nice round. Thank you all. All right, so Commissioner Arriola is on his way. He'll be here in just a minute. This is the July 24th, 2019 Land Use and Development Committee meeting. Welcome, everyone. I also expect Commissioner Malakoff to be joining us this morning. But I wanted to start on time. We have several items today that deserve proper discussion at the Land Use Committee. And so we're going to begin with a presentation from staff on item 12, which is proposed amendments to the comprehensive plan as part of the evaluation and appraisal report. As staff is preparing the presentation, I would just ask City Attorney Nick Kalergis to make any announcements.
I have no announcements. No?
Okay.
Thank you.
I have, if you want me to announce the ones that have been deferred?
I think we should because, okay. Yep.
If anybody is here for item 3, which is a discussion on the ordinance amendment accepting office uses, not also operating as entertainment establishments or dance halls from the definition of neighborhood impact establishment, that has been requested to be deferred to the September 18th meeting by the sponsor. Item number 5 under verbal reports, which is a discussion on a proposed ballot question pertaining to an FAR increase within existing parking garages, that item has been withdrawn and will not be considered. And then lastly, the discussion item number 6 regarding incentivizing new developments to include units for workforce and affordable housing, that item has also been deferred to the September 18th, 2019 meeting at the request of the sponsor. And then this is already listed as deferred, the discussion to review the role of land use boards in neighborhood improvement projects, item number 13, that's going to be deferred to the September 18th, 2019 meeting.
Thank you, Tom. So let's begin with item 12.
All right, we have a PowerPoint presentation. All right, let me get the clip. Okay, so good morning, Madam Chair. I'm going to briefly describe the update based on the evaluation and appraisal report. First of all, let me just, for the audience, let you know what the comprehensive plan is. It's a document required of all local governments by Florida Statute Chapter 163, and it is a blueprint and regulatory guide for the future commercial and residential development of the city, for climate resiliency and adaptation, for conservation of natural resources, housing, recreation, transportation, cultural activities, historic preservation, and on and on and on. It establishes a minimum levels of service to meet the current and future needs of the city. And basically everything that the city does has to be consistent and compliant with the comprehensive plan. So when we do amendments to our zoning ordinance, we have to ensure that they're consistent with the comprehensive plan. Other documents that the city has, the capital improvements element, resiliency strategy, other policies and procedures, the code of ordinance have to be consistent with the comprehensive plan. Florida statute requires an evaluation and appraisal of the comprehensive plan every 7 years. The last time we did a major update based on the evaluation and appraisal report was in 2011. There was a change in the comprehensive planning law, so that delayed this current update. And the update is required to include updates to Florida statutes and other local initiatives. The comprehensive plan is required to have certain elements per statute 163-3177. including capital improvements element, future land use plan, transportation, sanitary sewer, solid waste, drainage, potable water, natural groundwater, aquifer recharge elements, conservation, coastal management, recreation open space, housing, intergovernmental coordination. Within each of these elements, the city's comprehensive plan differs somewhat in how we name them, but we have all of these elements in our comprehensive plan. And then each element is organized into goals, objectives, and policies that set out the procedures that the city is going to undertake. So just some of a quick summary of the amendments. We're modifying the planning horizon of the plan from 2025 to 2040. We're going to be updating the goals, objectives, and policies to be consistent with changes in state law. We're going to remove obsolete statutes, citations to statutes and the Florida Administrative Code that no longer exist. And we're updating the goals, objectives, and policies due to changing conditions in the city, of which climate change is one of the big ones that we're focusing on in these amendments. And we are modifying the organization of the comprehensive plan to improve its usability. Currently, it's very difficult to know what is located where, so we're making it internally consistent. We had a lot of policies that were duplicated, so sometimes we'd have amendments and we'd amend it in one section and didn't realize that we missed it in another, so we're kind of removing those duplications and making it an internally consistent document. So with that, we've been working with a consultant, Aaron Sita from KCI Inc., is going to be describing briefly some of the major updates to the amendments. So it's down to move forward.
Good morning, Aaron Sita with KCI Technologies. The first element, we're going to really spend a lot of time on the two biggest elements, which were the two, I would say, heaviest lifts of this particular project. One of the things I really want to emphasize is a huge portion of this project was a reorganization of the elements, and we really wanted to make this a usable document, and we wanted to make it easy for the development community, for residents, citizens, as well as staff to be able to go in and crack this open and find what they're looking for. So you'll see a lot of italicized text within the elements, and that just means that text has been moved over and hasn't been changed. So the first element is going to be the resilient land use and development element. And again, just by renaming it, we're showing that we're emphasizing that resiliency and sustainability component throughout and really trying to bring that home. And of all of our elements, what we've done is we've added a paragraph at the beginning of each element explaining the element. What is the purpose of this element? What is that element going to govern? Another really different thing that we did for these two elements, the resilient land use element as well as the climate resiliency element, is we added principles of review. And these were principles so that we can always do a gut check. We can go back and make sure that the decisions or the amendments we're making, it's a way to say, was this intent with the original vision, with our theme of the element, what we wanted to accomplish in the big picture goals? And that's a really, it's a nice addition for staff. Certainly. So we did remove parking as well. That went and got incorporated into public facilities, and then we also updated for internal consistency and clarity. And then, of course, the climate and resiliency. We combined the conservation and coastal zone elements into the climate and resiliency element. And the principles, the review principles in this particular element, are all taken from the ULI Miami Beach study as well as the Harvard study. We, again, organized, simplified, and consolidated. Thank you.
Just briefly, we had made some minor updates to the other elements. To the transportation element, we improved the goals, objectives, and policies to encourage alternative modes of travel, incorporated policies to increase the resiliency and co-benefits of transportation infrastructure. For the housing element, we incorporated policies to encourage development of more sustainable housing within the city. For historic preservation, we reorganized that element, strengthened that element, and incorporated policies to direct the city to establish resiliency guidelines for the preservation of the historic buildings. For recreation and open space, we incorporated policies to enhance waterfront and bayfront access. For the infrastructure element, we provided policies to direct that infrastructure be provided that furthers the goals of the climate and resiliency and sustainability element within the city. Incorporated Miami Beach Freeboard requirements into the comprehensive plan. For intergovernmental coordination, we incorporated partnerships that the city has established regarding resiliency, such as the South Florida Climate Compact, Resilient 305 strategy, partnership with Miami and Miami-Dade County. And for the capital improvements element, we updated policies regarding the capital facilities planning procedures and updated levels of service to be consistent with what's actually being provided. This is a sample, if you want to describe this quick sample.
So what, part of what we did is we also reimagined the comprehensive plan and the formatting and the look, and we wanted to continue that Miami Beach rising above branding into the comprehensive plan. Again, we wanted to make this feel usable and friendly to anybody who picked it up. So that this is what your comp plan will finish it up when we come back for adoption, but this is the general idea of what it's going to look like.
So just quickly, the next steps, we're going to have a transmittal hearing July 31st at the City Commission. At that point, we transmit the amendments to seven state agencies, the Department of Economic Opportunity being the primary land planning agency of the state, FDOT, Department of Environmental Protection, South Florida Water Management District, South Florida Regional Planning Council, and also to the adjacent municipalities in the county. Within 60 days, we expect a report from the land planning agency called the Objections Recommendations and Comments Report that will provide us with different things that we need to amend within the plan, things that they feel are inconsistent with state law or state important state resources, and then each agency will have their own comments based on their purview. And then with that, we'll amend the amendments to address their comments and concerns, and then we'll come back for adoption likely in the October hearing of the City Commission. Okay. So with that, if you have any questions...
Terrific. I know there's Mr. Burkow is here. He had a concern regarding Blue Ways, so I'm going to allow him to elevate his concern. And if anyone else came for this item, please go ahead and approach the podium.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members, Jeff Burkow, 590 Lakeview Drive in Miami Beach. The concern that I have, this is a great job, and it's a much-needed update of the comprehensive plan. And I congratulate staff and the consultant on that. However, a policy was added to the recreation and open space element, new policy ROS 1.4.3. The city shall continue to implement recommendations in the Blue Ways Master Plan to increase the interaction of residents and tourists with the waterways in and around the city. My first concern about that is that I don't think it is good policy and good planning to elevate an external document to the importance of the comprehensive plan. It has not been subject to the scrutiny, the notice, the procedures that the comprehensive plan has been subject to, and I don't think we want that to become the law that has to, with which everything else in the city has to be consistent. As an example, there are provisions in the Blue Ways Master Plan that would propose increased interaction from the single-family areas to the water in the form of kayak and canoe launches. And as you all remember, a very heated battle that we had about 3 years ago for the Cherokee Avenue street end, where it was firmly decided by the commission that that type of use would not be allowed in the single-family neighborhoods. So to recognize that, you have clarified policy ROS 1.1.5, or the consultant has in the attachment, to make it clear that waterfront access in non-single-family development to all shorelines shall be required, but not in the single-family areas. The recommendations of the Blue Ways Master Plan are inconsistent with this provision. So my recommendation to you is you either delete policy ROS 1.4.3 or call out the specific policies from the Blue Ways plan that you want to incorporate in the comprehensive plan so we can make sure those are subject to the type of scrutiny and public review that's required of a comprehensive plan amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Burkow. And you did point out to me the discrepancy between what the master plan says and policy 1.1.5. So, Tom or Susie, how do you want to reconcile this conflict?
We think it would be better to amend the Blue Ways Master Plan to be consistent with commission direction to remove the single-family access.
Okay.
And so we're going to get with the Environmental and Sustainability Department and the Parks Department to bring to the commission in September a modification to the Blue Ways Plan to confirm that it does not include access from single-family districts.
Okay, because I agree with Mr. Burkow. We don't want to relitigate that. We did that. The commission made a decision. Actually, it was not on the prevailing side, but that's fine. I'm not looking to retrace those steps. I think we made a decision. We should stick with it and probably update the Blue Ways to eliminate that conflict.
My concern about that is just one of timing and process. Will the amendment to the Blue Ways plan occur before second reading and adoption of the comp plan amendment?
It would be before, because if we bring it to the commission in September, adoption of this year cannot happen until October 16th.
Okay.
And what happens if the commission decides not to make the changes in September to the Blue Ways plan?
I mean, I'm happy to make a commitment to you. I don't know if Commissioner Malakoff,
yes,
Commissioner Arias, we could all co-sponsor and make that commitment to you that we'll see it through.
It makes no sense.
That's terrific.
Because in the single-family districts, there's no place to park cars except on private property. So it really was not consistent with what our comprehensive plan should be saying.
Is that satisfying? If the three of us co-sponsor that and
well, that's
commit
terrific.
To seeing it through?
Will there be some sort of notation on transmittal that that's going to happen?
What do you mean?
July 31st is transmittal.
Yes.
So will this
put it on the record that we're going to do this?
Yeah, we can certainly put it on the record on next Wednesday.
That's fine. Then you can have the commitment from all seven.
Excellent.
I'm sure no one's looking
to
go backwards in time.
I have a couple of questions. I'm so sorry that I'm
late.
One question is, authorizes the city to explore replacing recreation and open space levels of service with the park's impact fee to provide for additional flexibility? What is that?
So the current way the levels of service are structured, we have specific facilities for which we have to maintain levels of service. And so we currently collect concurrency fees that are supposed to fund those specific types of parks improvements. So those are swimming pools, golf courses, basketball courts, tennis or pickleball court, designated field area, multiple-use court, tot lot, vitacourse, boat ramp, outdoor amphitheater, or activity for multiple uses. We collect money for the specific facilities that we are deficient in. Currently, those are multiple-use courts, soccer field, and there's one other facility that we collect a proportionate fair share mitigation fee when we get new residential or hotel development.
Okay.
So the money that we collect is supposed to fund specifically those three types of things that we are deficient in. With an impact fee, the proposal is not to raise any additional money. It's the idea is we'd collect the same amount of money, but the city would have additional flexibility in how that money is spent. So if the city doesn't want to build a multiple-use court, it wants to build a basketball court, even though we have enough basketball courts, the city would have that flexibility to do so.
That
so that's sense. That's the idea that and it's to explore. It's not mandatory. The idea is that be explored at some point in the future.
That's fine. And I have a question under 2, climate resiliency and sustainability. I just don't understand it. What does it mean, incorporates strategies to promote placemaking as a way to complement sea level rise mitigation strategies? What does that mean, please?
So the idea is that we would be creating resiliency districts. And so placemaking is looking at what are the things that create a community? The streetscape that creates a community. And so have a streetscape that's going to have co-benefits and is going to assist with drainage, but also creates a place that people want to be. So you have shade, so it makes it walkable. You have parks that people want to be at. So you look at everything in a community that makes people want to be there, and the idea is to make sure that those things that make people want to be there have co-benefits that can provide for resiliency.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? All right. Well, I just want to compliment staff and the consultant. I did attend the public meeting where you obtained the input from the public. It was very informative and helpful, and I'm sure shaped what is now, a great edit to the comprehensive plan. I mean, really embracing everything that we did with the Urban Land Institute and the 100 Resilient Cities and carving out that path for the future. So thank you all. I'm sure by acclamation, Commissioner Arriola, would you like to move it with a favorable to commission?
Absolutely. And Madam Chair, do you also want to include in that a recommendation for staff to do the amendment to the Blue Ways Plan?
Absolutely. I think for the comfort of the public, if you would review it as quickly as possible, propose those edits, and you've got your three sponsors here to see that through to completion. All right. So now we will move to item 11, discussion to create options for indoor ambient entertainment.
Okay. Madam Chair, what I can do is I can go over the changes that have been proposed pursuant to the recently released memo on this, and then Nick Kalergis will take us through all of the proposed changes in the permit ordinance. This particular item, which has been pending before the Land Use Committee since February, has evolved. As the committee may recall, last month the administration presented three different options. One was the first item that was part of the referral, which was just to simply amend the definition of entertainment. The other option was to create a separate definition for ambient entertainment. And then option one was the creation of a revocable permit process for ambient entertainment. After lengthy discussion, it was concluded that option one should be pursued further. Subsequent to the last Land Use and Development Committee meeting, there were some town hall meetings that were held both in North Beach and South Beach where there was a lot of different community input. And then pursuant to the direction of the Land Use Committee, the administration and the city attorney's office went ahead and drafted the proposed ordinance. It would be an amendment. It would be a non-LDR amendment to the city code, which would establish basically a temporary, almost special event-like permit. It's very, very similar to the special event process. Rather than going into the details on that, I'll let Nick go ahead and take us through the ordinance. But it is very consistent with what was proposed as option one at the last meeting.
Perfect. Nick, before you do that, so since the last time we talked about it, I hosted two town halls that were very well attended, one in North Beach, one in South Beach. Thank you to my aide for arranging all of that. She did a beautiful job. And we had very many residents, and one of my hosts is here, Marie Peter, who hosted the South Beach meeting. We had a lot of good input, and even from both town halls, we made some final edits. The draft of the ordinance was reviewed with me on this past Friday and is here. Nick, I think it would be important, since the ordinance itself is a newer element, if you went through it very methodically and just explained every component that's in the ordinance.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I apologize in advance for my nasal voice. I've got a little bit of a cold. But I just want to start out by introducing the ordinance that's in your supplemental materials. The ordinance would create a one-year temporary revocable permit program for certain specified businesses to conduct ambient entertainment performances pursuant to the conditions and the enforcement requirements set forth in the ordinance. I'm happy to walk you through it part by part. The ordinance begins by defining the scope of the permit and program. The permit would authorize a qualified establishment to conduct ambient entertainment performances, which I know we've discussed this many times, but ambient entertainment would be any performance, live or recorded, that's conducted at an ambient volume, which is a volume that does not interfere with normal conversation, excluding, obviously, TV, radio, and recorded background music. The ordinance makes very clear that only certain establishments would be eligible for this permit. It would be only open to restaurants with an occupant content of 299 persons or fewer, and that are located in zoning districts in which entertainment is a permitted or conditional use currently. An establishment that already has a conditional use permit for entertainment would not be eligible to participate. And in order to be eligible, during the one-year period prior to the date of the application, an applicant could have no violations of Chapter 6 of the City Code pertaining to alcoholic beverages, of the special events ordinance, meaning if they've had a special event permit in the past and there's been a violation of the permit or of the permit ordinance, that would disqualify them, or importantly, the city's noise ordinance. So any adjudication of a violation within the one-year period preceding would disqualify a business.
And if I may interrupt you, that set of disqualifications I call, you know, like the bad actor clause. So if we have a record with a particular operator that they have been in violation of other similar types of permits or allowances, they would not have access to this.
Correct. The ordinance provides for an application process, which would be administered by the city's Tourism and Culture Department. We developed the ordinance that way because the Tourism and Culture Department is very familiar with, obviously they administer the special events process, and in many ways this is a similar process. The ordinance provides that the permit would have a term of 1 year. It could be renewable. And so long as the permittee had no violations of this section or any of the other sections. The ordinance also provides that upon application, copies of submitted permit applications must be provided to neighborhood associations and or business associations in the neighborhood where the applicant is located. This is similar. This tracks the provision applicable to special event permittees to notify neighborhood associations. The ordinance also includes a pretty strict set of criteria, of standards and criteria that would apply to anybody operating an ambient entertainment permit under the ordinance. It's clear that the permit is grants a privilege and not a right, that it's revocable at all times. We included a termination for convenience clause like we do in all of our city contracts, where the city manager could terminate upon 7 days written notice for convenience without cause. At no point can an ambient performance conducted exceed ambient volume. If it were to, it would subject the permit to violation enforcement, which I'll get to. Ambient entertainment performances conducted under this permit could only take place indoors. There's no provision here for outdoor entertainment. Ambient entertainment could only be conducted between the hours of 10 a.m. and midnight of each day. And then importantly, and I want to sort of underline these next two clauses, a permittee, as a condition of the permit, would have to agree to probably some of the strictest enforcement penalties we've ever developed, which is that upon the finding of a violation, the city manager, in the city manager's sole discretion, could revoke the permit. And the permittee would be, you know, at the outset, waiving any right to seek any administrative or judicial review of that revocation. The second piece of the enforcement conditions is that a permittee, as a condition of the permit, would agree that they'd have to allow tourism and culture or code compliance staff to enter the premises, the area subject to the permit, to ensure that the permit conditions are being complied with.
And that specifically, members, is to address one of the main concerns of the public, which was with conditional use permits, we have had operators that disallowed code enforcement access to the facility, which is their right to do, but causes what I call like a cat and mouse game of code enforcement, where code is denied entry and code is required to observe the violation, and while they're being denied entry, the volume is turned down, and then they're allowed to come in. And so, while there's been a complaint and it might have been valid, we really can't prove it. So this is to address that. Granting of access is a precondition to having the permit at all.
Correct. The ordinance provides that the city manager shall have the discretion to set a maximum number of permits by each area of the city, divided into South, Mid, and North Beach. This gives flexibility to the administration to gauge demand and to make sure that we have enough resources both in our tourism department and our code compliance department to make sure that the program is being administered smoothly. And lastly, I'd like to add that the ordinance provides for an annual review so that following the first year of the permit program, the administration would provide the City Commission with certain statistics relating to the number of permits issued, the number of active permits, the number of complaints of violations of the permits, and the number of permits revoked. So that at that point, there could, you know, the City Commission could evaluate and either expand or contract the program if it so desired.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. So, members, do you want to hear from the public first, or do you want to address any concerns in the ordinance?
I just want to thank you for spearheading this and having to suffer the arrows of the public for trying to do something I think that's very sensible. Let's hear from the public.
I guess I have some arrows.
Do you want to throw your arrows first, or do you want to hear from the public?
Let's hear from the public first.
All right. Anyone here to speak on this item? Just come on up, and we'll just go back and forth. So when you see one podium clear, if you're here to speak, just come on up to the other one.
Good morning. How are you? Marguerite Ramos, 1530 Bay Drive. I'm a member of a group called Nobi Partners, and we are HOA presidents in North Beach. And we decided to start this petition, and we have been watching it trickle down to South Beach because people have been signing in support of live music in Miami Beach restaurants. Very simple. If you haven't seen it, it's on change.org. And so far we have 328 signatures, and we hope to have at least 500 by the next meeting. So thank you so much for offering this pilot program. We think it's going to be fabulous for North Beach. It would be amazing to walk to our really cool restaurants like the Silver Lake Bistro, New Capri, Las Vacas Gordas, 71 Cafe, and Bob's Your Uncle Bar. These are all within walking distance. They're single-owned restaurants by business owners. They're not chains. And how cool if we could go to these places and hear a guitarist or a harpist or a singer. So that's my first point. I would like to read a letter, though, by Angie Chirino. She's a singer, and she lives in North Beach, and she was not able to come. That's okay with you?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think you all got a copy of the letter, and I'm going to go through the first paragraph quickly and then emphasize the second one. So Mayor Gelber and Miami City Commissioners, my name is Angie Chirino, and I'm a resident of North Beach. I'm writing in support of amending Chapter 12 of the Code of the City of Miami Beach entitled Arts, Culture, and Entertainment. Having spent a very large part of my life working in the music business here in South Florida, I know how valuable it is for our economy and what it has done to places in the cities in the global scene. It is the talent of people like Gloria Estefan, Pitbull, and my very own father, Willie Chirino, that have given our area the identity and have played a big part in placing the eyes of the world upon us. I feel it is our duty to preserve and to promote that whenever possible. When I moved to Miami Beach 3 years ago, it came to me with a great surprise to learn that live music was difficult to find due to the high level of restrictions. Of all places, Miami Beach, people from all over the world flock to our area to vacation on our shores and enjoy the nightlife. However, not included in that is the enormous part of what makes our city what it is. I find that hard to wrap my head around. For me, it is a tremendous disappointment to live within walking distance of so many venues and to not be able to enjoy live music. To have to travel outside of the area is simply unacceptable to me. South Florida has the gift of possessing a vast wealth of world-class artists from all over the globe. Miami Beach should be a city that highlights this and brings people to our area, as well as allows residents to enjoy some culture close to home, bringing in new revenue as well as keeping local dollars local. This is why I support this amendment and encourage residents to do the same. Sincerely, Angie Chirino, and she lives at 1185 Marseille Drive.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much. We're thrilled, and we hope everybody comes to North Beach for live music, but I would also like to go elsewhere in the city for live music, so thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. My name is Jorge Moreno. I am a local musician, also a business owner here on Miami Beach. I have a restaurant called Moreno's Cuba. We're in a zone where we're allowed to have the music, so I'm very fortunate of that. I'm just here to support the other restaurants that are not, because I think not only my competitors should be allowed to, but I might be in their position in a year from now if I want to open up another spot in the area where, you know, it's not zoned in. And I just think that, you know, music is really an incredible thing. If you're doing it, like, at an ambient level, you're not doing, like, this punk rock thing outside that's bothering the neighbors, we should be allowed to perform. And I think everybody here is probably with that. I think it's all within the matter of context. And I'm glad you guys are coming around to it. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you, because I remember when we actually proactively brought Collins Park to allow live music, you were one of the petitioners who were experiencing what had previously been a ban on live entertainment, correct? Exactly. What happened to your business before and after this went into effect in Collins Park?
Well, first we started with music. Then we were not allowed to do music for about a year. That's when I petitioned, and we had the Can-Do Arts District and so on and so forth. Now I'm on Collins. I moved one block away. We're allowed to have music again. But I can tell you significantly, there was a dramatic drop in business when I didn't have live music. I can tell you that a lot of customers, they call and they say, do you have live music tonight? Do you have what's performing? What kind of music is happening? I can tell you it makes a very big difference for tourists that are coming here when they're selecting a restaurant and one has live music and the other one doesn't. They're going to go to the one with live music 9 out of 10 times.
And specifically, what kind of music are you playing?
Me, myself, I play Latin.
Not you, but I'm saying I've been to your restaurant. But what it's nice music. Just tell people what's going on in your restaurant. It's a Cuban restaurant.
At my restaurant, it's like a Buena Vista Social Club type of, you know, Cuban, old school Cuban, 1940s, 1950s Cuba. And that also matches with a lot of things historically that were happening here in Miami Beach in the golden age of Miami Beach, 1940s, 1950s. In Wynwood, I have another restaurant, and I have live music there all the time, too. I have no problem. There's been none of this has been going on over there. And it's weird that the capital of tourism here in Miami Beach, there would be these laws, and over there wouldn't. So another reason I'm here.
Yeah, it's interesting. Thank you for coming. Morelos, everybody. That's where you can get the Buena Vista Social Club
Morelos.
Music.
Morelos.
Morelos. I said it with my gringa accent. Okay, that's all right. I'm glad you brought that up because while it's good for your business to be able to offer that, and you said you noticed a drop in business when you weren't able to offer it, it's also good for us residents. Miami Beach people love to eat out. I think most of us love the amenities that being such a tourist capital, all the great restaurants, all the great arts and cultural experiences that we can have, that's why we live here too. We want the most fabulous restaurants. And it's so often when I travel, I'm disappointed by the quality of the meals and the quality of the entertainment because it's so good at home. But this is really, it's really a part of it. So, I think it is for residents personally to be able to have a restaurant like yours in our neighborhood that we can go to and enjoy. Thank you.
Yes, good morning. Ronald Starkman, I'm president of South Fifth Neighborhood Association. And first of all, Commissioner Alleman, I'd like to thank you for coming to the South Beach area and hosting the town hall. And I think you didn't talk to about the reactions at the town hall, but I think it was a very different reaction from the South Beach crowd than there was from the North Beach. And a lot of that has to do with I think that there are different neighborhoods have different characteristics. And I can speak specifically to South of the Fifth, but we are bordered on the north by Ocean Drive and that entertainment district. And for years, we've had to battle that activity moving south. It's not people playing violins or pianos. It's things like the Hookah Lounge, which plays hip-hop. And then we had an issue, too, with Radio Bar, which was playing dance music. And what the issue actually wasn't the noise coming from the establishment. The issue is the crowds outside. And in the case of Radio Bar, for example, it was after the music ended, all the people that were mingling, and it was directly across the street from the courts. And in that case, the operator agreed to move the entrance to the rear by a parking lot, away from the residents, so that dealt with that issue. But most establishments don't have that option. So the concern really is you put a midnight on this, it means that if you've got a restaurant next door to a residential building, those people are still going to be disturbed, and it's not a code violation. I mean, these are just people out on the street doing what people do, gathering, you know, bringing their cars around and so forth. That's not going to be solved with the code. So I think that as you look at this, you've got to pay close attention to where you have commercial, even if it's just a restaurant, adjacent to residential. If it's, we have no objection to In other parts of the city, which are primarily commercial, creating a new class of permit, which will be a lot easier to get. There are plenty of other neighborhoods where restaurants can locate where they wouldn't have the restrictions that we would want to have for residential. And even as I look at areas like Wynwood, which I have been frequenting as well, I'm not finding those popular restaurants having live music. They're popular because they're in a cool neighborhood, and the food is great. Even the Electric Pickle, which used to be the live music establishment there, closed. So it's not about live music, but it could be in the entertainment area. We understand that. But this, as currently conceived, still does not seem to address the protections that we feel we need in the residential areas. And I'm just saying in closing that as you look at Ocean Drive and those other areas, the economic engine is commercial. If you look at areas like South of Fifth, the economic engine has been residential. So it's the residential that you want to bend over backwards to protect in those areas at the same time as you want to maybe promote more commercial development in other areas. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you a question. Would you support the banning of live music at, like, Monty's, for example? Because if Monty's were to be opening today under the way the law is currently constructed, Monty's would not be allowed to have the kind of entertainment they have now, which is live entertainment. And I think Monty's is certainly an amenity that the South of Fifth neighborhood enjoys. And if they were to lose that, I think that would detract from the quality of life. Yeah.
Just to throw out an idea, I mean, with Monty's, the issue was a little less severe. You've got the only residential nearby is Rebecca Towers, and those people don't hear that well, I guess.
No. You have the Icon and Murano Grande right there.
But you
have the Murano Grande and Icon sitting pretty much on top of it.
But you also have a big parking. You have the room so that the people are gathering. They're not disturbing so much the residential. So I think, you know, maybe if you just speaking off the top of my head, if the establishment is far enough away that, you know, I don't know how many hundred feet from a residential building, and they have the space and the area so that by the operation that's going to attract more people is not going to disturb the residences, then that's probably fine because you've got a huge parking lot there at Monty's. And you've got multiple ways of getting to it.
But think about it, okay? You're a smart guy. If Monty's were to be petitioning today to open air, live entertainment with capacity for probably 800 guests, I'm guessing, you guys would shut it down. And I think if you were to ask South Fifth residents, do you want to get rid of Monty's, you'd have 100% agreement, no way.
Yeah, but
I'm just thinking.
When you say that
it's all residential, and I lived in South Fifth for 15 years. If you take away the amazing commercial establishments that are South Fifth, Joe's, Prime 112, Milo's, Monty's, all these things, take it out of the neighborhood, I would argue that South Fifth wouldn't quite be the South Fifth that we all know and love today.
Look, if you were to take what's performed at Monty's and move it to where SIBO is now or something, you would have a big, you know, there would be a problem. The problem doesn't exist with Monty's because of where it's located and the amount of space. So if this ordinance provided some sort of a circumference or some sort of a distance from the residential, then something we could talk about.
I can't imagine somebody coming in saying, we're going to open a live entertainment venue with a pool that people can jump in, open day and night, a block away from the Icon and the Murano Grande, that would fly in today's environment.
It wouldn't.
But the truth is, it does work, though. It does work. So this can work.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to reiterate just one point, which was that this permit ordinance doesn't allow anything where it isn't currently allowed now, either as a permitted or conditional use. Only restaurants in districts where entertainment is permitted or conditional would be eligible.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning. My name is Esther Overton, and I live south of Fifth. And I want to thank you so much for putting this forward. My only disappointment is that the south of Fifth is not included in the pilot. But I have to tell you that it's very disappointing to see so many businesses closing down. And I think one of the issues is because we don't have live music. I have my kids are in their 20s, and me myself, when we go out, we're always looking to see where we can go out and eat and enjoy some nice music, live music. I was in Naples just a couple of weekends ago, and it's a residential area, and they have some cute little restaurants in the area, and there is live music playing inside the restaurants. And it was a great environment, great atmosphere. And I'm disappointed because our neighborhood, you're right, it's not just residential, but thank God that we have all those nice restaurants. And one of the reasons we move and we like and enjoy living south of Fifth is because we can walk everywhere there, and we can walk to the restaurants that we have in the area. And it's a shame because I know the Bakehouse, Chibos, I mean, especially Chibos would love to have had live entertainment, and unfortunately they weren't able to. And I think it's hurting us more than anything else. And I think as a resident, it would be an enrichment to any neighborhood to have something like that. So thank you again, and we all don't support it. And, you know, as far as the gathering outside of places, I don't think that has anything to do with live music. Gathering, it depends on the establishment and the type of venue it is. I don't think live music would have anything to do with people gathering outside or not if it's kept inside and done as your ordinance suggests. So thank you again.
Thank you. Tom, Radio Bar, that's a bar. That's not a restaurant. Am I?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, because it's one of the challenges of trying to drive this conversation has been that people point to operators that they're unhappy with, but they're invariably not restaurants. I don't want to name names because I don't want to out, you know, any business, but Radio Bar was mentioned by someone else. That's not a restaurant. They're not covered by this. So to point to Radio Bar, or there's a bar in Sunset Harbor that has been mentioned. Even Nikki Beach and the Mondrian. Well, Nikki Beach and the Mondrian, one of them has an entertainment BTR for outside entertainment. And the other one has an entertainment CUP for outside entertainment. They're completely unrelated to this proposal. Mr. Tachmas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Alex Tachmas for the record, Hudson Bowen, 200 South Biscayne. Just very quickly, following up on Commissioner Ariola's comment, I think it's great what you're doing. It's something that, frankly, should be automatic in a city like this, and I know it's not, and we appreciate your hard work and persistence. So I wanted to make a technical comment. As you know, I represent a lot of hotels and restaurants and bars. On the occupancy cap that is in the ordinance. So the cap is 299, and I'd make two comments about that. First, if the criterion is that no music can be heard outside and it's a purely inside venue, I don't really understand what the reason is for capping it at 299 when, as long as the music's not heard outside the four corners or the four walls, it could be 400. I don't really see why that number is there. The second issue is a more technical one. When we go for conditional use permits in front of the planning board, the planning board's approach and planning department's approach is to aggregate the occupancy of all venues in a location. So a hotel could have three restaurants, and for determining whether we qualify or require to get a neighborhood impact establishment, all those are aggregated. I would recommend in this circumstance that you not aggregate that, so that if a place has three restaurants or four restaurants, and each one is separately enclosed, the 299 should apply to each venue. If not, you may then be aggregating all the venues on site, and it could be, say, five restaurants, each of 70 people, and then the entire venue would be subject to that. Commissioner, do you have a question?
I'm not sure I'm following that scenario. I think I know what you're trying to say, but I'm trying to envision
the conditional use permit says you need a neighborhood impact establishment CUP if the occupancy load of the combined food and beverage venues in a building exceed 300. So a hotel could easily have three or four venues, and in the aggregate, it's over 300. So in this circumstance, I just think it would be unfair if you aggregated them all. If you have four different restaurants all enclosed, one is 200, the other one is 250. As long as they're all separate and enclosed, I don't think the number should be aggregated for reaching the 299. Thanks.
Makes sense.
Good morning.
I'd like to thank you for what you are doing, Commissioner Alleman. Especially, I enjoy very much the meeting you held Mrs. Peter.
Your name for the record.
So, I'm sorry, Jose Frias. I'm being in South of Fifth since my late 30s, over 25 years ago. I live in different buildings, South of Fifth. I really enjoy very much what you are doing to keep us alive. That's the key. I thank you very much.
Thank you. How many more people wishing to speak on this item? Just one? Okay. Two more. Okay.
I'm Beth Emerson. I'm a North Beach resident. And I'm a musician, composer, songwriter, and singer. I do not like talking on camera at all. So here's what I want to say briefly. First of all, there are good operators and bad operators. And anyone that hosts any kind of music has to be a good operator. They need to be concerned about and cognizant of how it's traveling, both within and without side the doors. Okay, that's number one. Number two, it's expensive to put up live music. Nobody's talking about bands here. We are talking about a simple vocalist or a piano and something that can be contained within the venue. Okay? It's not about radios. It's not about types of music. Thirdly, in North Beach, we have several venues that do have live music. One of them is one I won't state in public, but they have bought the building. They are invested over $1 million in North Beach. They pre-screen. They pre-book. People come in and pay $150 to go in there, and you cannot hear a peep from the street. You do not know when they're open. Lastly, when I'm home and the first Fridays are on at the square and I live across the water, I cannot hear it from my balcony. So sound can be contained, and we don't have to deal with bad musicians, bad sound, bad operators, or bad guests, okay? They need to be taught how to go out and enjoy themselves and not disturb residents. Now, the last thing I want to say is, what's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? What's it all about when you sort it out, Alfie? This is a very hot microphone and room. And if I were in a restaurant, it would be soft. And once I am on a mic, it can be potted way down. And you can talk over me. Watch. What's it all about? How beautiful for spacious God forever waves of rain.
Thank you, Beth. Oh, my goodness. You are a lovely soul, Beth Emerson.
Beautiful. That's a tough act to follow, let me tell you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you so much. I just want to start off by saying thank you so much, Commissioner Allman. I know how hard you've worked. Personally, we've had many conversations about this and other issues. That you always strive to help and do your best, and also Ricky, as well as Tom and all the others. So Maddie, this particular issue, my name is Bernardo Sandoval. I'm the president of NAFNA, North of Fifth Neighborhood Association. I'm also president of Mirador 1035 Condo, vice president of Mirador Master Association. I've been a resident of Miami for 40-plus years. I've been coming to these beach venues since 1989. I don't want to give away my age, but let's say I've seen it all, and I think this is a long time coming. I think this is a good first step. Just to get into the stance of NAFTA, we presented you guys with a resolution. Our board looked at it, and we want to say that this initiative that you've proposed, especially in its current iteration, is extremely comprehensive. It's very detailed. It's very thought out and considerate. And I really think that there's nothing bad about this. I think you've done the best you could possibly do under the circumstances. I know you have to answer to a lot of different agencies and different groups, and I'd like to address that now. So as far as our group is concerned, we're in favor of it. Of course, there are some people that were opposed, but as you know, and we discussed, and after you've personally discussed with them, they were unaware of the details. Correct. They were going on with the misinformation and things that were spread that were not accurate. Primarily, and at the top of the list, is that this is an indoor program, okay? And it's controlled, meaning that the time is controlled, it's going to be very well monitored, and it's revocable. So this is a very innocuous initiative that you've proposed. That's why at the last town hall meeting, which I attended, which I was invited to by you at the Murano Grand, and I understand it was in South of Fifth, and I'm friends with Ron Starkman, and I respect him very much and his organization, but I was taken aback by the vitriol and the opposition to something so innocuous. Because, and I'll reiterate what I said there briefly, which is that would anyone here be opposed to having a live piano or a jazz player at, say, Smith & Walensky or Jones Stonecrab? And, of course, that's a rhetorical question, and the answer is no. And that's all that this is, nothing more and nothing less. This is not dueling piano bars. This is not CBGBs. This is not the pickle or whatever, you know. So the reality is that this is a good step forward, and we need to continue with this. So that being said, thank you. Now, my only criticism, and it was touched on by some others, although not so specifically as this, I understand that SOFNA or South of Fifth wants to be excluded. I understand that Sunset Harbor wants to be excluded, and that's fair enough. But what we haven't heard is the voices of those businesses, those restaurants. And I've personally spoken to them. I'm friends with some of them. And they recently just heard about this. And they said, Bernie, you know, we want to be involved. We want to participate. So my concern, Ricky, and I've touched on it with you, is that we don't want to put these businesses at a competitive disadvantage. Okay? And I understand Ron's concern, and they're valid, 100% valid. Believe me, I was on Ocean Drive recently on a weekend. Nobody wants that. We don't want that on West Avenue. I don't want them to have it in South of Fifth. Nobody wants that. But there has to be a balance. This is a good starting point. So I think that moving forward, and I'm sure you're going to pass this today, moving forward towards September, I think you really need to get some of those businesses involved and hear from them and find a way to incorporate them somehow, or at least have them give their fair share of their opinion and be considered. Because I think there must be a way to incorporate them. I know that they want to be involved. And that's basically all I want to say. And I want to thank you all again for working on this and other things. And we look forward to talking to you in the near future.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting. It's true that over the past week, the most feedback I've received on this is actually from South of Fifth and Sunset Harbor residents and a couple of businesses that are like, why are you leaving us out? Personally, as you know, as the one vote out of seven, I committed to those neighborhoods, their neighborhood associations, Sunset Harbor Neighborhood Association, South of Fifth Neighborhood Association, all the way back in January of this year. In writing, I committed that whatever I would propose at the end of this would allow an exclusion for them if they chose it. I realize, of course, that there are residents that live in those neighborhoods that actually want it. But because of the commitment that I made to their neighborhood association, that has to get, for me personally, sorted at the neighborhood association level. I do believe that over time, I think this is going to work, and I think it's going to be awesome. And my hope is that over time, the residents in those neighborhoods get comfortable with it, and they actually come to us and they ask for it. And I think we can get there, but you know, we ought to try it in the city. So I know that Joy has some, Commissioner Malakoff has some concerns. Let's hear them and see if I haven't addressed everything properly and see where we can go.
Okay. First of all, if you do include South of Fifth and Sunset Harbor, this whole idea of ambient music in restaurants is dead. That's number one.
I'm not sure that's true, but let me say that right now in the draft, they are, just for clarity, they're excluded.
Yeah, I'm speaking on behalf of residents throughout the city. I'm not speaking on behalf of either of those areas, but from people that I've heard from who live in those areas, I would say that's true. Okay. Earlier this week, there was...
I feel differently, and so does my building, so...
Earlier this week, there was an article in the Herald about Cafe Abbracci in Coral Gables. Miami Beach, rich and famous, all go there to lunch and to dine. And what is attractive about it? They don't have music, but what's attractive is people can talk at their tables in quietly. They can strike deals in hushed library tones, whispers that disappear into the recording studio acoustics. And how does this happen? Because nearly every inch of walls and ceiling is lined with acoustic panels, so conversations stay intimate. If restaurants have soundproofing, it would be an entirely different matter, and then I think all of the city could be involved. But putting in, as Cafe Abbracci has done, soundproofing on all the panels throughout the restaurant is an expensive undertaking. Reasons that restaurants are closing down are not because they don't have live music. The reason that they're closing down is because of higher rents, because they don't, some of them, like Chibo, doesn't have parking, and some of them just because their food is average and there are so many other restaurants with very, very good food. So blaming it on live music doesn't, I don't believe, makes sense. I have a problem with what ambient really is, because this is going to be enforced by code enforcement as well as the tourism department. And perhaps tourism officers will be more effective. But so far, code enforcement has failed our communities regarding noise violations. This has been going on for years and years. I compliment Commissioner Aleman on all the work she's done, because I think the only way this can work is with a type of special event permit. This is revocable. And I think as soon as a restaurant is cited for noise violations, they need to be closed down, which is in this ordinance, and not allowed to reopen for 2 years or something, because I just think that we do have good actors who are going to abide by the ambient entertainment permit program, and there are others that are going to have bands playing that are going to bother residents nearby. I would advise soundproofing, but I don't think it can be mandated because of the cost. I know Mr. Takmas talked about increasing the number of 299, but as soon as it gets over 299, they require a conditional use permit, and I think that should remain in effect. I was thinking about making it less numbers to have smaller restaurants. There's a lot of nightlife. There's a lot of music in the city of Miami Beach. So as far as tourists are concerned, they can go to any hotel on Collins Avenue. They can go to nightclubs. They can go to places on Collins Avenue, Washington Avenue. Well, Washington Avenue soon, still under construction. Washington Avenue, Ocean Drive for live music. I think that this could pass the commission with some tweaks. One of them, as I mentioned, was soundproofing. The other is if the music would be really what you're talking about, and that's piano, you mentioned harp, you mentioned a guitar. My question is, what if it's a band playing and you have bass and you have drums? Is that going to be compatible with being, quote, ambient? I don't know, but I don't think so. Therefore, the only way I think that ambient entertainment performances can be effective in restaurants is if the hours are changed from 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. each day rather than midnight. So if, in fact, the music is louder than some residents would like, at least it stops at 11 p.m. And you don't have people at midnight coming out of the restaurants. There usually is alcohol involved as well. And I think that's what's been bothering people, particularly in West Avenue and some in South Beach and some in other areas of the city. I think this is a good idea to have on 41st Street. I think it's a good idea to have in North Beach. I know people from North Beach have spoken and said they'd like music in their restaurants. They're mostly small restaurants. They certainly could have a guitar player or a piano player. It would be very attractive. But I find difficulty in the hour of midnight, and I find some difficulty in who is going to enforce it, because so far code enforcement has not been effective.
Thank you. To address a couple of your points, this pilot does not bring ambient entertainment anywhere that entertainment is not already allowed. But ambient entertainment doesn't happen. Only loud entertainment happens. You know why? Because of our process and our rules. So we require someone to go get a conditional use permit from the planning board. That can take 5 months or more. That will probably cost upwards of $10,000. So for a bar that wants to have live entertainment or an entertainment establishment in the MXE, they don't have a problem. They're going to go to the planning board, and they're going to get that CUP because that's what they're offering. And that's where you'll see the bands. you will not see ambient entertainment because it's not worth the expense and effort to a small business if they just want to have something soft that's actually real music. I said this at the South Beach Town Hall, and it points out just how preposterous our legislation is, that a restaurant can have a player piano, the mechanical kind that you plug in, but if you actually have a piano and a piano player, that's not allowed. It's ridiculous, honestly. You also cannot have, I focused on music because that was really this has been a labor of love, and that was the inspiration. But this affects other performances as well. You cannot have someone stand up without a microphone and recite poetry. It's not allowed without a conditional use permit. Who's going to spend $10,000 and 5 months of effort to go in front of the planning board to have some spoken word, you know, at perhaps on Valentine's Day, to have someone reciting Shakespeare sonnets or something? They're just not going to do it. And so we're degrading the quality of we cast ourselves as this, global culture and arts destination, but we're not walking that talk. And this is an effort to begin, you heard the city attorney say it, these are the strictest language we've ever developed, and it's just for ambient. The only reason that's so is, to address concerns of certain pockets in the community that have had problems, not with indoor. The problems that we've had in our community have been really with outdoor and really with special events, generally outside. So to require something like soundproofing, if you're going to go get a conditional use permit from the planning board, that's a condition that the planning board is going to put upon you based on what you plan to do, which you're going to have to describe. To require soundproofing, which is highly expensive, so that you can have ambient music, it's excessive, and it will put us right back where we are today, which is that nobody will bother. We had 300 classically trained musicians in town for the past 5 weeks. They were available to tourists. Tourists could go see them in the entertainment district, but residents couldn't enjoy that because we don't have it in North Beach, we don't have it in Mid Beach, we don't have it in many parts of South Beach, places where they can just play like you heard as you entered the meeting. So I think we need to get real about this, and it's structured completely revocably. It's a privilege, not a right. We can revoke it for no reason at all, at the discretion of the city manager. So I truly hope that my colleagues can support the pilot.
Yeah, I'm fully supportive, and I'd go further than you have, just because I think the way you've drafted this addresses the concerns of, I think, all residents, pro and con, because it's about ambient entertainment. There's a lot of protections in here, and I would like it to be citywide. Because there's a lot of mechanisms for undoing it if there's a violation. And there's just so many examples, like were listed here, where it's something people want. You want to be able to go to a restaurant and hear a piano, right? I think it's a bad image for the city to be so restrictive, and to carve out certain neighborhoods because they're a little bit more politically active than other neighborhoods. But it's still bad policy, and I don't believe in enacting bad policy just because, there's a neighborhood association that's going to support or not support you. Do the right thing. I know my neighborhood, Sunset Harbor, and I've lived in both neighborhoods that are carved out of this, and one of the things that attracted me to those neighborhoods is because of the balance, right, of commercial activity and quality housing and safety and the beauty of those neighborhoods. But without the commercial, I know I would not want to live there because it becomes very boring, right? And some of that commercial activity has live entertainment. I know that in my neighborhood, Sunset Harbor, there was a microbrewery that was very interested in moving in, and they said, we can't have live entertainment. So it would have been the first microbrewery in all of Miami Beach. They're not coming. They're going to Wynwood. We just had a business open and close within 5 weeks. They had a lounge that they couldn't activate. And so she told me, she goes, what am I going to do with this? Like, yeah, come have your you're part of your meeting here, but you can't play any music. And so what's going to happen, my fear in Sunset Harbor, for example, is if you look at the storefronts that are closing, we're really close to a tipping point where it's going to go to urban blight, where you're going to have more store closings, more storefronts closed than are open. And then we have to ask ourselves, is that really what we wanted to achieve? We're not there yet, but you can see it heading. Rents are rising. It's becoming less attractive to folks to come in because it's so restrictive. And that's what's going to happen. That Chibo site in south of 5th will remain dormant, my guess, for a decade. It's big, it's too restrictive, and I think that detracts from the quality of life of folks who live down there to not have that activated. Because that was a great amenity for the neighborhood when it was open, but the way it is now, that will not be open.
You mentioned Chibo, and there was an article in the Miami New Times about Chibo going out of business south of 5th, and I'll just read from the article. The hospitality, they were talking to Nick Donato, the CEO of Liberty Entertainment Group, and said the hospitality executive also cites the city's prohibition of anything other than ambient music in the restaurant's patio area, making it essentially impossible to host private events. In this case, it's a little bit different because they were talking about, you know, outdoor and wanting to be louder than ambient. But I talked to Cafe Avanti about this on 41st Street, another restaurant that, in addition to just, you know, you and I going to eat their delicious Italian food, they also host a lot of private events. And I asked them, what's the materiality of them being able to say to an event host that you could have a guitar, or you could have a piano, or you could have, you know, one of the nice, you know, classical instruments that we've had here. And they think it makes a material difference in their ability to attract business. So it's true that the city cannot edit content, so we can't describe what sorts of instruments it would be. We can't describe what genre of music it would be. But what we can do is enforce volume. And ambient truly means not louder than a normal speaking conversation. So this concept that it could be a band, a rock band or something like that, it's just false. Because, how is that rock band going to be able to perform at an ambient level? So, all right. Well, Commissioner Ariola,
I have one other
comment.
On Section F of the actual ordinance that's been proposed.
What page is that on?
Number 3.
Okay.
Additionally, in order to ensure compliance with this requirement, permittees shall use all best efforts to ensure that doors and windows remain closed while performances are taking place. I don't think we should have all best efforts. I think that the permittees should ensure that doors and windows remain closed while performances are taking place.
Well, we have an issue with doors because, of course, people have to use them to come in and out. So I think that's valid for windows, that we could modify that to say that windows must remain closed. However, if you're walking down the path of trying to require a business to install a double-door vestibule just to have ambient music, which is not louder than a normal speaking conversation, you're putting on requirements that are more consistent with the conditional use permit, very expensive requirements that have nothing to do with ambient. So to talk about double-door vestibules or, you know, soundproofing, those things are required when you're going to be louder than normal conversation. And I agree. You should require those things through the conditional use permit process. But in this case, we are not louder than people talking. So if, Tom, we could probably tweak that, or Nick, separate doors and windows. Windows must remain closed. Doors best efforts, because of course people do have to come in and out.
The windows are usually closed anyway because people have air conditioning. So.
Yeah, because it's hot.
Sure.
Exactly. So we can tweak that.
I'll move it.
All right. By acclamation, with a favorable to commission. Now, this is not going to go on the July 31st commission. We're going to take it to the September for first reading, October for second reading, should we get that far, and I hope we do, because Matt Kenny, who I see in the back there, is the director of culture and tourism. He is the one that administrates the special event permit process, and I want to give Matt, you know, a month to begin to frame out what the permit would look like and how he would administer it, and to work with code to have a conversation about that back and forth, in case there's questions about that at the September meeting. Okay, so, all right. Well, thank you all that came to talk. I really do believe that because our definition of entertainment already excludes recorded music, not louder than normal speaking conversation. For me, I don't have any trouble getting over the hurdle of saying, well, whatever you can do on your stereo, you ought to be able to do in person. That's not difficult for me. But we've put in a lot of work. When I say we, I mean Nick Kalergis and Tom Mooney and folks like that, to write this ordinance so that we can pilot it and get the community comfortable with it. And I do hope that someday in the future we can cross that hurdle of whether it's citywide or just building it into the definition of entertainment. But this is a great way to start, totally revocable at the city manager's discretion, and will be revisited after the first year. So for all of you that came for this item, hopefully you'll come again to the September Commission, because I don't expect the conversation to get any easier until it's done. So thank you all. All right. Okay. Now, I don't know if anyone's going to sing on the next item, which is, let's do Terminal Island, because I know we have a number of people here for that, and that is number
nine,
simply a discussion regarding Terminal Island. Commissioner Malakoff, you are the sponsor of that. Would you like to get us started?
I think we really need to hear from Terminal Island to see what has happened in the interim. As far as I'm concerned, this is an excellent use of that particular property for various reasons, but I'd like to hear where things are now. I know as far as a resident of Miami Beach, I believe that it is a win for our city, but I'd like to hear more from Terminal Island folks, and then I'll speak again.
Good morning. My name is Tracy Slavens, address 701 Brickell Avenue. I'm here on behalf of Miami Beach Port LLC, the partnership that owns the Terminal Island property. I'm joined this morning by our exceptional team, and we're going to present to you the proposed redevelopment of Terminal Island. As you all know very well, until recently, this was a cargo terminal that clogged up the MacArthur Causeway with semi-trucks and traffic log jams of people trying to get in and off this island. And in 2014, a new plan for this waterfront property emerged that proposed a landmark project that incorporated a condo tower and a state-of-the-art fleet management facility for the city. Since then, our team has worked tirelessly with the city to design this fleet management facility, and we've been led by Architectonica to consider the needs of every stakeholder in this beautiful and innovative design of the project. We've also met extensively with the community. We want to ensure that their quality of life is not only protected but enhanced by this project. And now, 5 years later, we're ready to move forward with the project. We're here today to walk you through the design concept and the public benefits of the project, and also to walk you through what Terminal Island is today. I think it's very important that everyone realizes that this is an industrial property, and the impacts of industrial development on this property are pretty major for MacArthur Causeway and the residents south of Fifth. But its distinctive location gives it a unique characteristic that could allow for a mixed-use development that not only incorporates the industrial needs of the city, but creates a development on this property that's both economically beneficial and beneficial for the community as a whole to contribute to our quality of life. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to John Paul Perez. He's the vice president of the Related Group, and he's here to talk to you about the vision for this property.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for having us here this morning. John Paul Perez, vice president of Related Group. Before we show you the video and go through the presentation, I just thought I'd say a few things that make this site unique. I'd like to share with you a few things about Terminal Island being one of the only private port properties on the east coast of the United States. Terminal Island's value lies in its deep waterfront. Just as its name suggests, Terminal Island was created in the 1940s as a passenger and cargo terminal and had operated as such until 2015 when we ceased a cargo operation, eliminating 120,000 semi-truck trailer trips a year from the MacArthur Causeway. The elimination of the cargo operation was done in the best interest for the city and for the residents of Miami Beach, and we wanted to show our commitment to developing a product on site that was the least impactful to the community. Since then, we've been working diligently with various neighbors and stakeholders in doing our best to ensure that that Destin port-related industrial use never returns. It should be noted that given the 50-foot water depth surrounding the property, the intended industrial uses are unlike any other that one would find in similar type industrial sites. Within the last few years, Port of Miami has become the busiest cruise ship port in the world, resulting in multiple cruise ship terminals being built. This new construction has displaced the smaller regional cruise ship operators, resulting in these operators looking at different sites for possible terminal locations. So as a developer of the property, we're faced with a difficult situation if we pursue these other industrial uses or we continue to move forward and try to work together to create an iconic project with the City of Miami Beach. Not only will there be there increased traffic and disruption to the residents if this use is brought back, but there will be no added city benefit, as Tracy discussed, which we'll go through later in the presentation. We have always prided ourselves on related to doing what's best for the city. As you know, we started in the 1970s rehabbing old apartment buildings, and now all the buildings south of Fifth, the high rises you now see built, were done by our company. We always try to do what's best, and we look forward to working together with the city to try to work towards building an iconic project at the entrance to Miami Beach. So now we'll start with the video, and then next will be Ray Ford from Architectonica.
For decades, Terminal Island has served as an industrial center housing an FPL plant, U.S. Coast Guard base, a city maintenance facility, and until recently, a busy cargo container facility. As part of a plan to bring a boutique residential building to the island, and in response to calls from residents to reduce traffic in the area, in 2016, the Related Group removed the cargo facility, eliminating 125,000 semi-truck trips annually. Plans for the residential building continue to progress, adding positive community impact with the proposed creation of a new, privately funded city fleet maintenance and sanitation facility. That facility has been servicing the vehicles and equipment that provide crucial services to the residents and guests in the city of Miami Beach. The Fleet Management Department and the Sanitation Division of the Public Works Department call the facility home. The facility maintains the fleet of more than 1,000 city vehicles and other specialized equipment needed to serve the community. It also houses the only city-owned fueling station. Nearly all city vehicles, from police interceptors and fire and rescue vehicles to school buses, and from street sweepers to garbage trucks, satisfy their fuel needs at this location. However, as critical as the facility's role is to ensure that the daily needs of the entire community are met, it has not undergone any major reconstruction or expansion in decades. This is largely due to the limited area and configuration of the city's property, as well as the need to preserve continuity of critical fleet maintenance and repair services without any interruption to city operations. The limited size of the property severely limits the availability of on-site parking spaces and vehicle and equipment storage. On any given day, up to 75 vehicles, both standard size and oversized, can be found parked along the state roadway and right-of-way fronting the fleet facility. To compound the problem, as many as 160 sanitation day shift employee and city service vehicles currently park off-site in the city's 17th Street parking garage, taking up valuable space that is intended to generate revenue for the city of Miami Beach. Similarly, as many as 30 to 60 new vehicles may be temporarily parked in the Pennsylvania Avenue parking garage during vehicle replacement cycles. The Related Group is proposing to build a new, state-of-the-art fleet maintenance facility for the city at no cost to taxpayers. The new facility will feature more than 50,000 square feet of administrative offices for fleet management and sanitation, warehouse space, regular and oversized vehicle service bays, an upgraded fuel station, full backup power generation capacity, and a parking garage to house vehicles currently being parked throughout the city and its public garages. The facility will be partially built on additional land being provided by the Related Group on adjacent property. This will make a phased construction plan possible, allowing for all ongoing and future maintenance to proceed without any service interruption. The additional property size will also allow for the phased construction of the parking garage. This new fleet and sanitation parking garage will accommodate vehicles and equipment currently being parked both on and off-site. Consolidating outside vendor services, new vehicle delivery logistics, and sanitation service and employee vehicle parking at one location, therefore increasing operational productivity and efficiency. With the development of the City of Miami Beach's new fleet maintenance and sanitation facility, the Related Group is proposing to develop a residential project on the adjacent privately owned property with no more than 90 units. Once completed, the City of Miami Beach will receive more than an estimated $2.9 million in annual tax revenue from the development of the adjacent residential project, in addition to the new privately funded maintenance facility that will serve the entire Miami Beach community for decades to come.
That quick video is to give you an idea of the larger scale of the project. Ray is here to walk you through the plans. We think it's important that we show you how this is going to work because you are dealing with an operating fleet management facility that handles all of the load of the City of Miami Beach's fleet and sanitation needs. And they need to continue operating while this project gets developed. So Ray is going to walk you through our phasing plan and then show you the layout of the property. What you'll note is we are dedicating land to the city for additional footprint for this fleet management facility. As part of our development plan, we will shrink our property's footprint and give land to the city as well.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Ray Fort with Architectonica. If you wouldn't mind putting up the PDF that we have prepared, I can walk you through where we are. So in this process, we've met extensively with George Cano, the facilities manager, to really understand what are the needs at that facility. And I'm sure everyone understands the location of where Terminal Island is located. It really is located at the junction where the MacArthur Causeway begins its turn onto the island of Miami Beach. And so several factors were taken into consideration here. Number one, the city facility really can't not function. So we had to come up with a plan that allowed it to function autonomously while the new facility was being constructed. The image that you see on the screen here is what the island looked like up until 2016, and it's amazing how the geometry of the existing city facility site was being utilized and maximized. I actually really applaud George on being able to organize that site. It's not an easy site to lay out, given its geometry and non-orthogonal sort of configuration. So since then, the site has been cleaned up aesthetically, and what you see highlighted in red is essentially the area that we've established that's needed in order to phase this project properly. So beginning with that, I'll run you through some of the site images. This is what it looks like today. Every surface lot is portion of the surface lot is being utilized. This is the service court of the existing facility. The service bays are always in use. It is a facility that is really being pushed to its limits from what it appears when we walk the site. And what we're proposing is to clean it up and provide the much-needed parking and service bays and administration offices that are necessary for this to function. And in the red dotted line that you see on the screen is the area that is being turned over to the city facility from the main site in order to make this happen. It's about 26,750 square feet of land area, and it actually is where the majority of the new facility is going to be located, about 141,000 square feet of area, including the garage, will be on that 26,000 square foot portion, with a total square footage on that site of 231,000 square feet, so about 60% of all the development occurs within that piece. It really is what makes the phasing possible. So on the ground floor, we've incorporated the 17 service bays, administration offices, parts, warehouses, storage that amounts to about 34,000 square feet, and oversized vehicle areas within the service court, fueling station, truck wash, sanitation waste, clam dump. It's all been included within this plan and has been closely studied with the facilities manager. With that in mind, we had to make sure that the residential portion of the site was also properly vetted. And in context, you see that Miami Beach essentially sits perpendicular, or the coastline of Miami Beach sits parallel to the coastline of Terminal Island on the west side. And most of the buildings in that instance are actually oriented, especially the larger ones at the entrance, are oriented a little bit more south. And we've essentially oriented our buildings so that the short end of it is perpendicular to those buildings, thereby making the slimmest possible side of the building facing in that direction. And so with that in mind, let me walk you through the phasing. This is an axonometric of the project site, and it highlights what is the city facility, which is the buildings set in various tones in the foreground. Another thing to point out, just for good measure, is that one of the city facility buildings is set pretty close to the water. Today's standards indicate that you'd want to have a 25-foot clear area around the perimeter of the island to accommodate for fire trucks and general safety on the island for access. So by constructing the new facility, there also is a safety factor as it relates to the operations of that area. So we have the existing facility, existing site. The first piece of it will be constructed purely on the future development site that's highlighted in green. This allows us to demolish the first building that is highlighted in red here and move everything into that building once it's constructed. And then on that site, Then the next building, highlighted in green, is constructed, and then thereafter, what's highlighted in red is demolished, so that you are continually building the new component first and then allowing it to be occupied and demolishing what it's replacing. Both of these, this is a multi-level portion of the project, so we have a garage above. We've measured the ramps and turning radii within the garage to accommodate four larger trucks that are towing cars into the garage to work, and it's all isolated. The ramping is isolated on the right side of the page or of the garage, as you can see here, in order to have quick circulation up and down the garage before having to go to the length that is on the western side. And then the remaining buildings get demolished and replaced with the new and last components of the building, with finally the service courtyard being completed. And this essentially becomes the completed project. As a whole, we wanted to unify the aesthetic of the building with the overall development that would occur. We think of it sort of as an ocean below the residential building, almost like a sailboat that's emerging, or a sail that's emerging from the ocean. You often don't see the boat itself, just the water and the sail that is extending above. And we've curved back the upper portion of the building, as we want most of the views to be oriented towards the south and out towards the ocean. That is also a reason for the building being oriented perpendicular to the edge of the island itself. You can see in this image that it is intended that the broad side is out towards the ocean, not towards the Coast Guard side, and the upper units then have the terracing back that is orienting it to the south, not to the east. And the triangular piece that you see on top of the parking garage, that is a trellis that is over the city facility, unified in look, but separate in plan and in function. And this is a view from Miami Beach, an aerial view that puts it into context as we see it from a lot of the high rises that are along that coastline. And then a view from what is over Monty's. You can see that it's quite a distance away from Miami Beach, but would serve as an addition to the skyline as we look back towards the city of Miami. And that really concludes the presentation, but I'm glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. And before we talk, if I could ask you then to move these off to the side. Okay. Commissioner, you asked to speak.
Thank you. Yes, I believe that, as I mentioned, I think it's a win-win for the city. The residential project, I think, is a great option. It's only, I understand, 90 units, and it will bring about, I think it's $2.9 million to the city each year. But these are luxury residential units, people who have yachts, people who spend a season here or a few months, and it's going to definitely decrease transportation, decrease all the number of cars and trucks on MacArthur Causeway, which has been a problem to people living in Miami Beach for years and years. I think that this proposal is absolutely positive for the city of Miami Beach, for fleet management, and for the use of Terminal Island.
Thank you. Yes, and from an impact standpoint, we did take a very close look at the traffic on the island, both when the site was operating as a cargo facility and what the city facilities' traffic demands are, what their peak hours for their shifts are, when people are coming and going, and what it basically mounted down to was a huge reduction in traffic. The terminal, the actual cargo terminal was generating approximately 125,000 truck trips a year. With 90 units of seasonal residents, that goes down to a couple hundred trips a year, which is a huge benefit to the MacArthur Causeway and anybody that travels on it. It's also, you know, to have a tower, an iconic tower like this at your city's entrance is really something special. I think it really welcomes people to Miami Beach. It serves as an icon for the city. And I think it will also complement what's coming on you know, the Parrot Jungle site and the deck site, where there are plans for very tall hotels and condo buildings. So, you know, it will help to create an aesthetic as you enter and exit Miami Beach that will be really interesting and beautiful for everybody. And, you know, in this process, we have been working with our neighbors to understand their concerns beyond traffic for what, you know, what are the things that will impact them or, they perceive will impact them. That's why we've oriented the building the way we have. We feel that to have the narrow side of the building facing towards the east is important because you end up limiting the amount of exposure that any person inside the building would have to what's going on below, particularly on the Coast Guard site. And for the residents along the south of Fifth Waterfront, you know, they're not looking at a flat surface. They're looking at a sliver of a beautiful building that blends in with the skyline beyond. And we, you know, we've also understood that there are, you know, concerns with compatibility between having a city facility that handles sanitation and having the Coast Guard site next to us, that there may be noise and smells and activities that a typical residential owner isn't used to. We think that between the marketing of this site as something unique on a waterfront, on a port, the type of buyer that we will attract is going to understand the environment that they are walking into and becoming a part of. But we also want to make sure that everybody's protected. So we have drafted and have been working on various easements and nuisance waivers that would apply to the air above us, the land around us, and all of the things that could affect somebody. So it covers the city's maintenance facility, it covers the Coast Guard station, it covers the water and sewer department issues that may come across the channel. There's a fuel storage facility on Fisher Island right next to some of the apartment buildings there. And there's the shipping activities that happen at the Port of Miami. And I think it's important that any buyer is made aware of those things and accepts them in writing when they walk through our front door to purchase.
They'll be part of the condominium documents?
Both condominium documents, easements running with the land, and nuisance waivers recorded with each unit.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Tom, help us out here. I know that Related has a private application for this project, and of course we have the referral for the discussion here. So, you know,
how do those things work together? What's being presented to you here is basically the concept, and it has two significant parts. The first is the required land use changes, because right now Terminal Island, which is zoned I-1, does not permit residential, and the maximum height is 40 feet. So a little over 2 years ago, the developer made an application to the planning board that's pending to amend the comprehensive plan and to amend the LDRs to allow for residential uses on Terminal Island and to increase the maximum overall height to accommodate a condominium tower. Those are currently pending before the planning board. The proposal to integrate this as a unified development site with the city vehicle maintenance facility, that would also require a separate development agreement. To date, we have not been given a term sheet or any type of contract document that's being reviewed by the city attorney. If and when that happens, that would require a separate referral to the finance committee where it would be vetted at that time.
Okay. Do you want to hear from the public on this then?
Yes.
All right, let's do that. Anyone from the public here to speak on this item?
Hi, my name's Marie Peter. I'm the president of the Murano Grande, also the chair of the Safety, Traffic, and Pedestrian Committee, South of Fifth. I'm here representing 10 of our fellow presidents of our condominiums. Our concern is, I'm not even going to get into our concern about air rights or zoning or FAR or how that's going to happen, because I don't think we're anywhere near that at this point. Our main concern is the Coast Guard. We've read the letters. I know the captain's here and he's going to be speaking. We can't get past the fact that the Coast Guard feels this is a serious security issue, which is disappointing to us that this is even being considered until that has been resolved, and it has not. I also was happy to hear that you're looking at the comprehensive plan, and in looking at that comprehensive plan, there is a rule 3.4, which is cooperation with the military installations. And it states in there, the city will cooperate with the U.S. Coast Guard station located within its jurisdiction by exchanging and providing information to prevent encroachment of incompatible land uses in order to facilitate its continued presence in the city. That alone was put there in 1989, has never been changed in all the changes that you've made to the comprehensive plan, and in hearing this morning, it is not being changed again. It is not part of what you were presented with this morning. Also, in part of, there's quite a few pieces to the policy which protects the Coast Guard station. In 1989, obviously, that was a very big priority and has continued to be for our city and for our residents. Also under that policy rule, the city will take into consideration any comments provided by the commanding officer while making such decisions regarding comprehensive planning or land development regulations, and will forward a copy of any such comments to the state land planning agency, which I know that you will go ahead and do long before this is approved. You can't, you know, I know you're not approving anything. I'm just saying we are nowhere near FAR and all the things that have to go on this project. I live in a related building. I have respect for the related group. If the Coast Guard wasn't involved in this and the security and your own comprehensive plan, we could be talking about FAR. We could be talking about you maybe having to give some of the property title. We haven't even legally know whether you're going to have to do something with your title if you're giving them FAR and you're taking part of the space. So please, I know the captain's going to come up and speak. That it should be our priority first before we worry about how big the building is or what it looks like. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. The city is very strongly considering the Coast Guard. That's why we're just having a discussion today.
Okay, Ronald Starkman. I'm president of the South Fifth Neighborhood Association. We had prepared a resolution last time this was heard, and I had spoken to it at that time. Just want to summarize a couple of the highlights. In May, the developer first presented their latest plans to the SOFNA New Projects and Development Committee, which is chaired by Frank DeValchio. And we also had at that meeting a number of the affected buildings on Alton Road. And we held a public meeting at the Bentley Beach Hotel a few weeks later, to which the entire SOFNA membership was invited. Since the project has been around in various forms for several years, Frank DeValchio had already spent considerable time looking at the traffic impact and also worked with the developer to get agreement on restrictions on commercial development, including restaurants, hotels, and also on short-term rentals, which the developer had agreed to. At each of these meetings, people were in support of any steps that could reduce traffic. And we subsequently received a letter from Mr. Cano, where he laid out in some detail how he's currently having to shuttle vehicles back and forth between garages and the garage and the inefficiency there, and the various ideas on how that would actually reduce the amount of traffic that the city is causing at that location. Also, there were no objections raised at any of those meetings to the actual design of the building itself, as long as it was less than 100 units. There was, however, a very clear expression of concern that we must not lose the Coast Guard station. For that reason, our resolution states that SOFNA has no objection to the project if the Coast Guard station remains in place. Some people have mischaracterized our position as supporting the project despite the Coast Guard issue. We've been consistent that the Coast Guard be retained and given the benefits for reduced traffic and other public benefits of the fleet maintenance facility. We are encouraging the city to try to work something out with the Coast Guard. Also, in talking with some who are opposed to the project, they are assuming that if this project isn't approved, nothing will be built on the property. We believe the developer, when he says they will do something, whether it be additional commercial development or an office building, so that, again, that would all make the traffic even worse than it is now. And finally, we did not take into account the view corridors of the buildings on Alton. We kind of viewed that as outside the scope, really, of our purview on this. So that was basically it. I know what the Coast Guard's going to speak.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Harry Motti. I'm the commanding officer for Base Miami Beach. As it's been mentioned, this issue has been around for a little bit of time. These are not just my opinions, but these issues and our concerns have been briefed up all the way to the Commandant and Vice Commandant level, as well as they've looked at this and responded in writing through our deputy for engineering at the headquarters level. As you know, the purpose of zoning is to prevent the incompatible use within close proximity. And the city recognized this, of course, and that's why we have light industrial and residential is currently not allowed. Even the city's comprehensive plan lays out policy and processes to prevent the encroachment to the military installations, in this case, the Coast Guard. The language that related groups has proposed in the waivers and in the covenants, we've looked at those closely with our legal department. Unfortunately, they protect the developer. They do not protect us from any lawsuits, complaints, nuisance, or problems. Those still happen. Our main concerns are the operational security in the base. The west-facing bulkhead is the area directly across from where the development will be, is proposed to be built. That area is where we conduct our most sensitive operations. That's where the bulk of the narcotics offloads happen. That's where we transfer detainees, migrants, people seeking asylum, and those things. We want to protect the anonymity of the operators involved, our partners with HSI, CBP, as well as Coast Guard, and of course we want to protect asylum seekers' rights from public view as well. The last thing we need is a building that's towering over us at 485 feet, which anyone with a camera can put on social media within seconds. The personal security is also a concern. When people can monitor the names of the people walking off the cutters on their uniforms, getting into which car and driving home and following them is concerning to us. It's not unheard of, and there have been people approached looking for operational information on when cutters deploy and where they go. We deal with multinational, transnational, multi-billion-dollar transnational organizations that can afford to lose $1 billion in drugs within a month without blinking an eye. Off to our coast is the Bahamas, 160 countries. Can go to the Bahamas without a visa requirement, can sit there and wait until they can find someone to take an hour, hour and a half boat ride across the United States. Those are the people, those are the activities that we're concerned with, and that's why our safety and our operational security is imperative. We see people trying to enter this country from all corners of the world. It's not just the Caribbean. It's not just South America or Central America. We see it from Asia. We see it from Europe. We see them from Africa. It's also concerning because of the future, the risk to our future expansions and the missions of tomorrow. The 80s and 90s and what we did on the island back then is not the mission and the threats today, and it won't be the threats tomorrow. We would very much like to keep our security of where we're at and be able to maintain our missions and be able to merge to future missions. Residential opens up a whole other avenue for us. As the Coast Guard or the government looks to expand, change, switch out assets, or adjust to the threats of tomorrow, we must go through the National Environmental Protection Act, which requires us to consult with neighbors. Residential uses and residents or owners have higher standings in which they have grounds then to complain about the uses, the noises, the nuisances, the smells. And this becomes problematic for us in the future as we try to adjust to the missions and the threats of tomorrow. There's been options, offers that would the Coast Guard be able to screen potential buyers or renters, and obviously the government, we're just not going to be able to do that. We don't get into that business. And even careful screening does not eliminate the problematic people. Just in Fisher Island a year or two ago, there was a fake prince that was there. He was heavily screened but still resided there, later on arrested by the FBI. Nuisances and complaints will continue to happen. Port of Miami receives complaints from neighbors on Fisher Island. We receive complaints from our lighthouses, shining lights on people's condos, yet they knew the light was there when they bought it. It does not stop the complaints. So the development is very concerning to us. We are concerned for our security, the operation, the mission, and also the ability to continue in the future unimpeded. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain. Thank you for your service.
Hi, good morning. Claire McCord. I'm Vice President of the SOFNA Board of Directors and also a citizen of Miami Beach, 140 Jefferson. I want to thank everybody for coming, and the Coast Guard especially. Our residents, Ron summarized what we heard at two public meetings. Well, one was our development committee meeting, and then at our public meeting. Residents are concerned about the Coast Guard. I think information is power here. I don't believe that our residents right now understand fully what the situation is. Maybe with all three parts of this development, the residential part with respect to the law, what the development agreement would be like, the fleet maintenance facility, what is involved there? How would it be a benefit? And then the Coast Guard issue. What exactly is involved? I hear that there are concerns about lawsuits and nuisance suits. And then we hear about security. I'd love to know, and maybe this is stuff that we can't know, but I would love to know how that building would differ in the ability to intrude on security than, say, someone with good equipment at the Icon or the Marana Grand or the Bentley Bay. I'd like to understand what what the issues are a little bit better. One reason that SOFNA has not put out a newsletter on this issue is because it's difficult for me and for our secretary to get enough information in a newsletter that we felt we were doing justice to the issue. So just like with ambient music, I'm glad for the opportunity to discuss, to understand, because I think that's what gives us a reasonable approach. Right now, and I'll just call out the elephant for a second, I think the issue has unfortunately been a bit politicized, And you know, the government, is the fleet maintenance facility a public benefit? Well, you know, I personally think it is. Is the Coast Guard issue a serious security threat that should block the whole project? Perhaps. But that's something that has to be determined after full information is disclosed and discussed. So that would be my two cents. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else from the okay, yep. How many other,
good,
how much other public, before you start, Mr. Fuhrer, anyone else from the general public wishing to speak on this item? Okay.
Good afternoon. Nice to see everybody. Thank you for your time. Thank you, everyone, for everything that's been said. I really stand behind all of it. First things first, this is privately held land. Something is going to happen, and I think we all need to realize that. We have a lot of issues facing our city. This is an opportunity which actually could free up some other space for other things, and if people work together, we can have something fantastic. And it's really important with all of the issues that are facing us that people learn how to do that. Simple. This actually can actually help bolster security on the port if done right. It can be really helpful for us. I'm a New Yorker, if it's not obvious in my speaking. I know people that died in the Twin Towers on September 11th. I know people that escaped getting out. So I get the impact of security. That's really important. But again, working together, something really new is possible. So I would just encourage you folks to work with us and the community at making that happen. And also, I just want to be very careful. We have a lot of little groups that are popping up, and we don't know what's behind them. I've been sent several emails already about things that are going around from people that live in condos where you have board members speaking for condos without properly noticed meetings. And I implore you folks that are making these decisions to make sure you hear from everyone, read between the lines. Let's get the facts. Let's get this right as a city. It's great for all of us. Thank you for your time. Thank everybody, especially the Coast Guard and the police.
Thank you, Seth.
Thank you. Thank you, Seth. And it's true. I know I've received emails from various people from South Beach condo saying, you know, people are speaking for us from the presidents, but I'm not part of that group. I believe in this. I think it's the best thing that can happen to Terminal Island. So.
Thank you, Commissioner, and 100% with you. I just want to be clear with what I say. What's happening is not illegal when it comes to that, but it's not right. And I really don't feel like we as citizens have a fair voice. I was in favor, as I think everyone on the dais knows, of what's happening with the tower at 5th and Alton. My building board actually endorsed it. And I had a really big problem with that because they never spoke to us. And not only that, you have a lot of buildings here where you have vacation homeowners, second, third, fourth homeowners even. You don't get their voice. They're not voting. They don't see what's happening. They don't come to these meetings to get the real gist of what's going on the beach at large. They don't see the problems we have on Ocean Drive and on the beach itself. People that live here, this is what matters. Our tenants aren't really often here to talk about what's happening. People that might live here for 5 or 6 years at a time. We gotta hear everybody's voice. Let's get it right. Our beach is hurting. We have an opportunity to do some great things. Thank you.
Thank you.
Should we hear from Mr. Cano from Fleet Management?
We can hear from Cano, although I don't think that anyone's disputing. I haven't heard any dispute of the necessity of a fleet facility. I have some questions really for Tom, because this is not, there's nothing that's been, the comp plan amendment, the LDR changes, a development agreement, and other possible waivers or easements, and so none of that is before us.
Correct.
That's
not before you.
And so what is the process? The developer has a private application.
Correct.
How do those components get engaged then through the private application. What is that process? Because that's actually how this thing is progressing, is through the private application. It's not progressing because of the discussion here today.
At some point, everything will come back to the commission. So, for instance, the two applications that are before the planning board. The planning board, by code, needs to make a recommendation on those and transmit them to the commission. Once the commission receives them, the commission can decide whether or not they would want all three to travel on the same track, a potential future DA, and the two land use amendments, or if they want to first amend the land use and development regulations and the comprehensive plan, and then look at a DA, which would be predicated upon that. So ultimately, the commission will have to make a decision down the road how they want to proceed with that.
Okay, so all of these amendments would be proposed to the planning board?
Yeah, there's an application that's pending, and right now the earliest that they'd be able to have the planning board consider those for transmittal would be October. And so whenever, because it's a private application, we don't control that, so whenever these amendments do move forward at the planning board, they would then be placed on the next agenda of the City Commission, and the City Commission would make the final decision by a 5/7 vote as to whether or not to amend the comp plan or amend the land development regulations.
Okay. Do you still need to hear from Kano? I mean, I've toured the facility, so I'm very, very familiar with the facility.
I just want to add a few closing things. Back in 2014, when the project came through, it was designed a little bit differently. I think we've designed it better now, where we separated the uses from the city to our private development. There was neighborhood support from SOFNA, from the islands, from WAFNA, and from the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard had the same concerns, and what back then we had met with them multiple times, working sessions to come to agreement, saying that, you know, we're in support of the project so long as these four things are met. Those things were providing additional surveillance, office space, and parking in our building. And what we've been trying to do over the past 4 years, and especially now in the past month and a half, 2 months, is we met with the Coast Guard and have tried to tell them, hey, we would love to have these working sessions with you to see if we can, what can we do to further design the building to alleviate some of your concerns. One of those items could be, because they're worried about people having additional vantage points looking into their operations, we could put a solid wall facing the Coast Guard base and have all the units facing south. So there's ways to work with them. We just maybe need the city's help or some help from the city to say, hey, Coast Guard, why don't you two meet separately and try to work together to come to a solution that works for everybody.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So as far as notice on the planning board hearing, Tom, can you describe the notice? Because we do have a number of interested stakeholders.
The item is pending. When the developer's team is ready to move forward, we've asked them to let us know. It will have to be re-noticed for 30 days. So anybody within 375 feet will receive a mail notice. It'll be on the city's website. There'll be a published notice. So we still would have to do a 30-day notice. I don't know when they intend to actually move forward at the planning board, but at this point, the earliest that they could get to the planning board would be October.
Okay. And for anyone outside of that 375-foot legal notice perimeter, I suppose, remember, we have the MB Resident Connect, which is where you can sign up for proactive email alerts on any topic. On this one, I would just use the keywords terminal or terminal island.
You're from Mark, Texas.
Madam Chair, the only thing I'd like to add is that I believe we would need a new term sheet referred to the Finance Committee. Correct? Is that correct, Tom?
Yeah. Right now, we don't have anything that we could consider a contractual document to review. So once that's submitted, then the City Commission could consider referring that to Finance.
And I'm speaking as to the DA specifically.
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Malik, I wanted to hear from Assistant City Manager Mark Texas. Smile with me if you want to have George speak. Here he comes. Come on up, George.
Good morning, Mark Texas, Assistant City Manager, and George Cano, our Fleet Management Director. Happy to answer any questions that you have. We have had several meetings with the Coast Guard and with the related group on this project. There's a lot of different issues that have come up. From an operational standpoint, we have a serious problem at fleet maintenance, and we need to do something one way or another. And I know the related group has offered to work with the Coast Guard. One of the concerns that was raised today, because, and certainly security, when you throw out that security word, is something I think that we all take pause and we say, you know, we have to be concerned with security. The part that I don't, or I fail to understand at this point, is the way that they've laid out this building, and with their offer even today to have a solid wall. What I don't understand is that with the rights that they have today to put, they could put a cruise facility there, and if those ships docked on the side of the property, they would be way closer and have a way better vantage point to be able to take photographs, pictures, post on social media, and there'd be, you know, new people coming in all the time. And if they put an office building there, you know, they would probably maximize that site, and again would be much, much closer to be able to take those photos. So I don't understand some of those aspects, but from an operational standpoint, this works well with us.
We would appreciate, evidently, there's some difficulty in working, getting a meeting of minds with the Coast Guard, so those items can be worked out, because I agree with what you say. I think that if there's a wall where people can't directly look down, that would be very helpful, and there may be other ways to ensure the security as well as the hold harmless. Right. But I think that we need your help, or the city manager's help, or you acting city manager, to get the meeting of minds to try to work out an arrangement.
Absolutely. Be happy to try to facilitate that. The Coast Guard is a tremendous partner, not only
yes.
to the city of
Miami
Beach.
And they're so
Beach,
important. They're very important.
But our whole, our you know, South Florida.
Yes.
They're an important partner, and they do a lot of great things, and we certainly want them there.
Yes, we do.
We're hopeful that we can find a way to make this all work and be able to deal with some of those security concerns. Other things that I think that we may be able to look at in the future is being able to have, you know, the Coast Guard attorneys and their attorneys try to work on some of those covenants to strengthen them, that would give them some better comfort that there are things in place where they can't just, you know, have to fight against, you know, frivolous lawsuits where people have moved in and now they want to change the rules. So
good.
We understand those concerns.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Cano, you want to say anything?
Well, I would echo your comments as far as being a beneficial project for the city. Terminal Island has been the home base for fleet management and sanitation for decades. More recent circumstances and physical conditions have resulted in having to relocate some of the sanitation personnel off-site. This project offers a unique opportunity of enabling us to have a new facility, primarily through the donation of the adjacent 0.61 acres, because without that, it would be virtually impossible for the city to construct a new facility and maintain continuity of operations. The developer has offered the adjacent site as a staging site for the construction, for parking, to minimize the impact on our existing facility while the construction is going on. And needless to say, you know, we've gone through decades without major renovations and reconstruction, and the amenities as well as the productivity and efficiency features that would be created through the construction of the project would make a big difference. Right now, our facilities are in suboptimal condition. The city would need to spend millions of dollars just to bring them to operating a normal operating level. Not to mention, we don't have an accessible site. The new project would address all of that with minimal interruption. We would have full backup generation. We provide a critical service to most of the departments in the city, and it's important that we have the ability to continue those services uninterrupted. So the enhancements to the facility, including 24-hour backup generation, the ability to bring back the sanitation employees that were relocated to 17th Street parking garage, not all of them, but about 75% of them, would introduce also operating efficiencies in the sense that they don't have to come back to fuel. If there's a problem with the vehicle, that's where they're based at. a number of operational efficiencies for them as well. So it's an excellent project for us from an operational point of view.
Thank you.
To mention it, no cost to the city.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cannon. Thank you.
Yeah, as I said, I took a tour of that facility in 2015 with George, and he showed me the components of his operation, the constraints. He's really spread all over the city with vehicle storage for in-servicing and out-servicing and in various parking garages. So on that part of it, I'm very clear that there's a necessity. So I see Captain Motti has motioned me as well. Come on up if you want to say something.
One thing I left out. We don't have room to receive new vehicles, so we're also using the Pennsylvania garage intermittently to receive primarily new police patrol vehicles. Now, they're staged temporarily there, pending pickup by the vendors for upfitting of safety equipment and graphics. All of that, you know, the big car transports, unloading operations would be transferred to our facility, and those vehicles would be parked within the 397 vehicle parking garage that would be built. So that's another thing that would help to alleviate traffic congestion in the heart of this general district.
Thank you, George. Yeah.
I'd just like to add some clarity and just some of the comments. The waivers and covenants, that idea, we looked at that and scrutinized that back in 2017. Our attorneys went back and forth with related groups' attorneys on different proposed waivers or covenants. In the end, our decision and our legal team's decision was that we cannot find a way that it would satisfactorily protect the federal government. The concern about viewpoint and where you can see, the west side of that island is protected by Building 4, which is a long, thin, two-story building. That also blocks the view from the condominiums across from South Beach. So that's why you could see the island from South Beach. You could see our pool. You could see our general parking lot where our food facility is, the basketball court, some of our other general maintenance. But you can't see where we're offloading the drugs and where we're offloading the detainees, and where we deal with some of our partner agencies and their undercover operatives. Cruise ship, putting a cruise ship there, yes, they come, they go, they're transient. We also have abilities to deal with cruise ships and commercial traffic. We know who's coming, we get the manifest, we know who's on board. We get notice of arrival 72 hours out of everybody's on board, including the mariners themselves. We have regulatory controls to monitor those ships. That's how we protect the country from what is coming in from the sea. Related group did meet with us, I think that was early July, talked about various ideas. Talking is one thing, but I requested that they put it in writing, and which they did back in July 9th, I believe, and we're looking at various proposals and see whether or not they'll satisfactory can remedy the issues. But it still comes down to incompatibility. You know, the one thing you can't do is there's incompatibility between residents and industrial. There's still outdoor spaces, blank wall, solid concrete wall or not. Is there other balconies? Don't know. But there's still outdoor spaces. The graphics has two pools. Earlier today we talked, there was a conversation about ambient noise. Our operations aren't ambient noise, they're industrial noise. They're loud, they're intrusive. You're grinding on decks. These are heavy maintenance facilities on the ships. And, so I hope that adds some clarity. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So, anything else to add, Commissioner Malikoff?
No, that's it. Okay. Thank you. Thank you all.
Anything else to add?
Do you want to conclude the item, or?
I think we can conclude it here, right? Because the application in front of the planning board is what's going to drive the assessment of these multiple components. As I said, there's a comp plan piece. There's the LDR changes. There's a development agreement, and there's probably other legal documents having to do with easements and waivers. So that's the process that is right now driving is the private application.
Correct.
So I think we'll conclude it here. Is right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. All right. So that concludes item 9, and let's move on then to item 1. Discussion regarding a proposed development agreement in connection with the historic designation of the International Inn at 2301 Normandy Drive.
Okay, Madam Chair, as we indicated, and just for brevity purposes, we made two changes to the proposed land development regulations based upon the feedback that we received from the Land Use Committee at the last meeting. The first was there was concern expressed about having a blanket no parking requirement. What we suggested is that the HPB be given the ability to waive the parking requirements based upon operational standards being substantiated. So rather than just saying no parking requirement, the HPB would have the ability to waive the parking requirement. If the HPB did not waive the parking requirement under the current code, they could pay the one-time parking impact fee. Secondly, with regard to outdoor entertainment, we have put in a provision for no open-air or outdoor entertainment within the site. So those are the only two things that we modified on the LDRs. The development agreement remained the same. As we indicated previously, this particular item is before you for a recommendation, and as proposed, it would travel coterminously with a recently recommended historic designation of the International Insight. So if the Land Use and Development Committee moves us forward to City Commission, we could bring it to the full commission in September for a referral of these items to the Planning Board.
Thank you. Commissioner Ayala?
Yeah, I think we all are familiar with this item. This is a sort of, in my mind, I think the minds of many, is sort of a landmark building that for sure I think many of us want to see preserved and, you know, sort of repurposed for you know, potentially a better use. So this item is sort of to discuss how we might achieve that, and there's a lot of creative ways to do it. I've got some questions, but I think maybe we should get the presentation first, and then we'll dive into it. I don't know, Alex, are you going to speak?
For the record, Alex Tachmas. As I mentioned at the last meeting, I just want to make sure the context is clear. We did not initiate this process. Our client did not come in front of the city seeking development rights and proposing amendments to the code or the comp plan. So the initiating party was MDPL and other stakeholders who want to preserve the property through an involuntary individual designation of the site. So as a result of that, we then entered into negotiations with MDPL to try to find a way for us to be able to work out a compromise by agreeing to have our property designated as historic in exchange for certain development rights we would get that would compensate for the restrictions that would be imposed on us due to the preservation and designation. So frankly, this is more an issue for MDPL who wants this to happen. We are ready to proceed with the development agreement that we've negotiated with the city attorney, and that was presented at the last meeting. Or if the city decides not to proceed, you know, again, we'll just go back to operating our property like we've done. So I just kind of want to make that clear that we're not the ones who are coming here aggressively asking for give us this, give us this. This was dumped on us, and then we're trying to work out an appropriate situation that will make our client's the effect on her property palatable for us. Now, having said that, with regard to the changes that are being proposed for the last meeting, we understand we're in the middle of RM1, so outdoor entertainment at above ambient levels, we understand, is not compatible, and we're fine with that. But ironically, consistent with something that was said earlier today, we do think that if music is at ambient levels, we should be able to have a DJ and or live performers outside if music is at that ambient level. As far as the parking is concerned, Commissioner Arriola and I have spoken about some options, and we're looking at this really in a way to solve both our operational needs that we expect we're going to have and the city's desire not to just throw up their hands and ignore the fact that if we have a successful venue, that there may be 20, 30 cars that are coming for happy hour or whatever at what we hope will be a very successful bar and restaurant. So while we would prefer what we had before, which is eliminating the parking requirement and we'll deal with it later based on operational needs, we can agree to something where we would agree to provide some parking at a remote lot, not necessarily within the 750 or 1,000-foot area, something akin to what the standard does, simply because there isn't a lot of land nearby, and our architects are telling us that they know we can't satisfy all our parking on site. So we can discuss something where the HPB would review our ability to have a remote lot for valet parking. We would want the ability to go into North Bay Village for that rather than keeping us only within the city confines, since there's more vacant land in North Bay Village than there is on the beach. So we think that that's probably the best that can be done. If you have other ideas, tell us, but that's the best that we can think of. And then just finally, on the security issue, there were a number of comments made at the last meeting. So as we indicated in an email we sent to all of you, our client has been diligently trying to address the security issues that were raised at the last meeting. So she met with Officer Blanco, who I know is here today, and he had presented certain recommendations for security. As a result of that meeting, our client has now entered into an agreement with a security company. I think it's Deco Security. I forget the name. It's the same company that does Soho House and Shore Club, and they're going to be providing security for 8 hours during the nighttime, every night at the property. Our client is getting bids for a fence around the property to be able to limit access to one specific location. She's also getting quotes now to change the access to hotel rooms from a key to a card reader. You can understand the potential for abuse. Somebody gets a key, they leave, they check out. 3 days later, the same key would operate a room. Now this will use an electronic reader, card reader, which would automatically be deactivated when our client wants to do so. So we are taking those things very seriously, and our client's taking the security issues very seriously. It's only been 30 days, but we're definitely moving in that right direction. So I hope we can come to an agreement and an understanding. As I said, we had teed this up pretty well with the administration and the attorney's office in terms of the DA that's in front of you. And then it's really a policy call if that's something that the commission wants to pursue. And then I'll defer to Daniel if he wants to add the genesis of this or more background.
Thank you, Daniel Serralda, Miami Design President.
Daniel, let me pardon the interruption. Okay. Come on up, Daniel. I saw you nodding your head. So one thing I just want to do is avoid the back and forth. I think Mr. Takmas characterized something that may or may not be factually accurate. Let me just weigh in for a second. I'm not so interested how we all got here, because I think we are in a good place where all the interested parties – we can move forward in a positive direction and get a positive outcome for the neighborhood, for the property owner, and for those of us who love the building. Please speak, but you don't have to debate how we got here. I think the fact that we're here trying to take what's been sort of a troubled property for the neighborhood and making it better, preserving it for the long term, and then satisfying the sort of economic and operational needs of your client, that's good. I'd rather sort of just focus on how do we make for a better development agreement that enhances the neighborhood, makes it safer, so our police are satisfied, as well as the neighborhood, and then the economic needs of your client to make this work.
Yeah, no, thank you. The only thing I want to mention was it was mentioned that MDPL initiated the designation process. I just wanted to correct the record, because the designation process, the applicant was the Historic Preservation Board. So that's all I wanted to say. We do have a development agreement that you all have a copy of. We support the development agreement, and we support the designation of the property. Thank you.
Two things that I will add to sort of the development agreement that's come up. The applicant had been requesting the parking waiver, and I don't think that's wise, and that's how possibly we're exploring another option where they can park off-site to meet the requirements in a valet service. It works for the standard. It's not perfect, but it does work. Guests and visitors understand that you don't have adequate parking in the neighborhood, so expect delays upon valet or just Uber there, but we have to have some kind of parking, because if this is to work, you'd have to have some kind of restaurant that would be open to the public that people would want to visit. And then I would be open to incorporating Commissioner Aleman's new live entertainment noise ordinance. I think ambient level live entertainment there will work. It works at the standard, and it's right next door to butts to a residential neighborhood, and most of that activity takes place in the early evening at sunset anyway. It doesn't go late, so I would be open, and I'd recommend that we go that route because it's on the water. People want to, you know, listen to reggae or whatever it is that, you know, makes people want to hang out by the water.
Yeah, and we don't have a position on that.
Tom, is there a mechanism by which we can waive the appearance fees for a conditional use permit? Because I can see how all of that could work if we're careful about the orientation of, you know, the development site and the orientation of where that would be, and that it could definitely work. I also am sensitive to the property owner. This is not a five-star hotel, and I'm sure the margins are lean, and it can be quite costly to appear before the planning board, to get a CUP. Is there a mechanism by which, as part of this, we could waive those fees so that it could all get sorted? Because the diligence that the planning board applies to these considerations is terrific, and I'm sure would be welcomed by all the parties and would help the residents that are neighbors feel more comfortable with what was happening.
We would have to amend the fee ordinance. It would require a separate referral. Although if they're proposing ambient entertainment, that's the requirement currently in the Collins Park area, where if they want outdoor entertainment, they have to go to planning board for that. We could include something similar within this limited overlay, that ambient performances would be subject to CUP approval. I don't know that it would be that onerous. We could bring back a separate ordinance to create a fee waiver process for that. But in this particular instance, I'm not sure it would be that onerous, given that it would be ambient entertainment only.
Right, right. Whatever the sponsor wants to do, I raise that because of those.
We appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's a good point. Alex, one thing. Do you anticipate or can you build a marina? Not a marina, but just a pier so that people can
we,
there.
I'm sorry, can we build a
can
what?
Can you build a pier for boats behind the property?
So there's a dock there now, but we haven't done a lot more research besides that. You know that this is in the Biscayne Bay Aquatic Preserve, where if there isn't an existing footprint from the state, doing a new one is super difficult. So I believe there are some rights there because of the pre-existing dock, but whether we'll be able to do something for, say, 7 slips, we haven't researched at this point yet.
I just think that if you're able to do that, it'll just make this project work so much better.
I agree.
If people can approach by the water, whether it's, you know, small craft or sure. Even if it's, you know, paddleboards and kayaks, but to have some way for guests to come by water.
No, I think that would be
it'll
great.
Make this project
and
work.
It also, it faces west, so you get the sunset at the end of the day, and yeah, it has a lot of potential.
What do we need to do here?
Did you want
to
hear? I know that I see PD there.
Are there some other folks
for this item?
Well, yeah. So we have our police department here. Would you guys like to speak on the update? Deputy Chief Jones, looking very dapper.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioners. Thank you, sir. The police department likes to see some positive changes at the International Inn. For too many years, we feel it's been a den of crime. Mostly prostitution and drug-related crimes. I know Officer Blanco spoke with your client to some extent, made some recommendations. I know Captain Dale Esperes has been paying special attention to this. I think I'd rather have them. It's more appropriate for them to come up and talk specifics. But anything that can happen at the location that will reduce our need to respond here so frequently, I think we're in favor of and support.
Good morning, Commissioners. Julio Blanco for the police department. I did meet with the owners on site, made some security recommendations. They were very receptive. The owner and her son were very, very receptive to at least the major recommendations I made, and there are signs that they're moving forward with some of them. I think if this is a great opportunity, and if they do execute on some of those recommendations, this would be game-changing for the property and for the neighborhood in whole.
Officer Blanco, you and I have spoken, I think, several times about creating safety through design, right? And so one of the things that attracts me to exploring this project, not just the preservation of the building itself, but through sort of repurposing it and allowing for some accommodations through design that allow for safety, right?
Correct. And the major recommendations were primarily access control, controlling who's coming in and out of the property. But supporting recommendations through design will be to activate, for example, the restaurant, to bring out the community, to have a Saturday, Sunday brunch, and change the image of the property and bring out the proper user, the good user, kind of eliminating the bad user of the property.
So what?
Anybody else want to speak?
Nope, got a couple.
Good morning, Kirk Pascal, 7915 Crespi Boulevard. Excuse me. So I'm excited about this moving forward. It's a beautiful building. Placement is fantastic for a beautiful gateway to North Beach. I'm supportive of the Hyatt. I'm supportive of the continued use of hotel. Since I'm here, I also, though, need to express my concern with regard to the parking, since this property is adjacent to an RM1 residential neighborhood with older buildings that do not have on-street parking. And from the last presentation I saw, they were proposing somewhere between 40 to 50 hotel rooms with no parking. And that's a choice. And for me, as someone who values our streetscapes, but also values the livability of our community, it's a hard choice for me to know where I stand, because I'd love to have more trees, more beautiful streetscapes, and no parking, and yet I know that the working families and residents in our community, they need parking when they come home from work. So I'm just urging, please, to try to take extreme caution. I actually, Mr. Mooney, I respect you so gratefully and everything, you know, the analysis and knowledge you bring to these discussions. I happened to catch the planning board hearing yesterday talking about parking requirements, and I just want to remind us, Biscayne Beach was not, it was a problem that was entirely created by the city in a RM1 community. It's not something that was bad planning, the way the community was laid out, and we still haven't fixed it, but I just don't want us to make that mistake again somewhere else and hopefully try to correct that one. And also, you know, when we're talking about new ideas to bring mass transit, I see us doing away with a lot of parking, but I don't see in North Beach, which saddens me, I don't see a tremendous amount of advocacy in actually bringing viable mass transit to bring people to work. It saddens me that North Beach is not a part of the county's smart plan, which to me implies that probably won't happen in my lifetime. I would prefer nothing more than to have mass transit where we didn't need parking, but I just want to reiterate that at the moment we do. Aside from that, I'm really excited and hope that this building can see a brighter day and be the beautiful gateway to North Beach that it deserves to be. Thanks.
Thank you, Kurt.
Good morning. I'd like to just address the same issue that I addressed in the previous meetings, is that how wonderful it is to have an agreement between the Historic Preservation Board and a private property owner. And when that happens, we find that the economics and viability of a project is taken into consideration, and there are certain things that are given to the property owner that enable them to take advantage or to extract from their own property viability. And I just wish that we would take a look at this and look at this as a model, as opposed to blanketly preserving. And I wonder why height, aggregation, additional FAR is viewed one way when it comes to International Inn, but it's viewed in another way when it comes to the Tatum Waterway. The discussions regarding the Tatum Waterway and adaptive reuse will need to take into this consideration the height issues. The recent developments in the Historic Preservation Board, in which they suggested that a property be lowered because of they felt it was out of scale, would not make sense or congruent with the current situation or the approval that the Historic Preservation Board is recommending additional height in the International Inn or with the Raleigh. If the narrative is that aggregation and height improve historic preservation, then the narrative should say true to North Beach and the Tatum Waterway alike. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just make two quick comments. One, on the issue of the parking, just be reminded that your code currently provides a parking exemption for historic buildings. So once this process moves forward and the building is designated as historic and a contributing building, automatically everything within that shell is exempt from parking. That's your existing code, and that applies everywhere. So the parking requirement would be triggered by anything in addition in the new construction. So I just kind of want to clarify that part. Second issue is just from a procedural posture. At this point, we're asking the Land Use Committee to move the DA, the development agreement, on to the commission. Once the commission approves the development agreement, then we'd be able to then start the process of the designation working on concurrently with the preservation aspects of it. So that's essentially the procedural posture. If you want to take any action, that's kind of where we are.
So, first of all, I have a comment about that, and I tend to agree. I think that because this is not something that the property owner requested, I would want to see the designation and the development agreement work in tandem.
I'm sorry, you don't want to see what, Commissioner?
The designation and the development agreement, because once the designation, without the development agreement being acceptable to the property owner, then the designation is being made against the property owner's will.
Well,
right? So yeah, how can that
The development
happen?
Agreement's already been approved by us. We've negotiated over the last several months with the city attorney's office, and the document in front of you has been blessed by us. So we need that to happen first, because then
that in front of finance?
Once that's agreed to, that then sets forth a sequence of events where we'll agree to designation and the code amendments at the same time. If the DA is not approved by the city, then every hearing now that proceeds on the designation, we have to start showing up and objecting to it.
Right.
With more and more vigor as it gets closer to getting an approval. And we want to avoid that. And that's why we're saying do the development agreement first, which says we'll designate and you give us this. And then we just proceed on a pretty amicable path just to check the boxes with the hearings. Without the development agreement, there's no guarantee we're getting anything in exchange for the designation. And then, as I said, we'd have to begin objecting to the designation.
Yeah, I certainly understand. Is the development agreement in front of finance yet?
No. The first stop was here. And so I think if you wanted to move this forward, what I would suggest is moving both documents to the City Commission so that they can refer the development agreement to finance and that you can refer the LDR amendment to the Planning Board. And then, pending your direction, we can wait and actually take it to Planning Board if and when the development agreement is approved, or we can take them all concurrently, whatever the direction of the Commission is.
And the sequence in the draft DA now is that the Commission will adopt the LDR amendments, and then after that point, the owner would not object to the designation ordinances. So the designation ordinances would move after, okay. The way it's drafted now.
Okay.
But the key issue is getting that agreement signed by both the city and us. Once that happens, it's pretty much on an automatic pilot, pretty much. I mean, okay. That's the key issue.
So I think that's important, and I also want to comment on the parking, because one thing is the hotel guests and whether we anticipate that a hotel guest would bring a car. But there are employees, and there will be hopefully a wonderful restaurant. The property is spectacular. You know, its location is spectacular. The historic features are spectacular. It can be an incredible, incredible gem. And it is the entrance to North Beach from the mainland and really can celebrate that. I mean, it's really very exciting, but it's important that that there's no negative unintended consequences on the neighboring communities. And I think parking is likely to be the biggest potential nuisance to the neighborhood if it's not addressed in the right way.
Yeah. So With respect to the development agreement, I don't know if we just amended here for further drafting, but with respect to parking, I don't want to see the parking waiver, and I don't think any of us agreed with that. But if there's a solution that'll work that can be off-site.
Even in North Bay Village.
Even North Bay Village, which I think it's just right over the bridge. So
right.
that can work, and I think probably allows your client more flexibility. And then I really encourage us and your client with respect to the noise exemption to allow for ambient live entertainment at the hotel.
Okay.
And that would be for ambient outdoor entertainment, correct? Because what we can do is we can make provisions for that and the parking and the LDRs.
Well, you could just add that to the, as you were mentioning earlier, Tom, to the overlay that's being created for this.
Yeah.
And just add and clarify that, because that's going to require a code amendment anyway, so that could just be looped into it.
Yeah, it would be specific to a site like this. So the parking, if they can't provide the parking on site, one of the options would be impact fee or providing the required parking within X number of feet, even if it's in another city. The only thing that I think we'd have to add is that it would be allowed to be provided with a lease as opposed to a covenant in lieu. Normally, you have to tie the two properties together. If the site is not in the city, it's going to be difficult to do a covenant in lieu. I think what you'd be looking for is something like a lease where you could show that you have access to these parking spaces via a lease.
Yeah, and then, of course, the key issue is removing the radius number
yeah,
of feet.
Yeah, the radius would have to be adjusted as well.
And then the HPB can approve the location of it, but, I mean, understanding that it's – I mean, if we could find a lot across the street, we would. It just doesn't seem likely. By the way, one other thing while I'm here, I don't know if you were informed, but we got a call from FDOT about 2 weeks ago, and they have, I think in response to the City Commission's involvement in the administration, they are now agreeing to fence off that lot that's next to us to the south that we don't own. That's a gravel lot. There's a lot of cars parking there or whatever, and it's been loitering and things like that. FDOT's gotten involved now, and they're going to fence off that area so it can't be used for loitering and whatnot. We spoke to them because since it's right next to our property, we may want to voluntarily contribute some enhancements to it so it doesn't look right. Like a standard FDOT chain link fence. Great. And we're in dialogue with Public Works to make sure that happens.
Chain link.
So
we have ordinances against chain link, so they cannot do that, but
remember, it's not your property. So I'm not sure if your ordinance is
the city. We have to authorize the fence.
Right. So you might want to meet with staff to understand, because we have some new standards for temporary parking lots, which that one probably qualifies
yeah,
for.
Yeah, this
wouldn't
right?
be a temporary parking lot. It would be fencing a vacant lot. But our new standards for fencing vacant lots require mm-hmm. it to be aluminum picket.
Yeah, we're in the process of setting up a call with, I think it's your transportation, with Jose Gonzalez, FDOT and us, so we can understand what's going on. Because we also wanted to cover some of the gravel areas. FDOT then said that grass would be a problem because it would cause flooding. So there's things that we would be talking about. But I just wanted to let you know, because I know for months we've been trying to get FDOT to
okay.
jump in.
So, Tom, help us out. Obviously, we need some referrals. What do you recommend?
So what I would suggest by acclamation, one, recommend that the City Commission refer the development agreement to the Finance and Citywide Projects Committee, and we'll bring that as a C4 in September. And number two, recommend that the Commission refer the LDR amendment to the Planning Board with the changes pertaining to allowing ambient outdoor entertainment and modifying the parking requirements to allow the off-site parking
okay,
option.
Yep.
And then we would bring that as a C4. However, we wouldn't bring it to the Planning Board until the DA comes back from Finance to the full Commission.
I was going to say, can we do it for next week, July 31st, for consent?
The referral on consent?
Yeah, the only thing is I'd have to check with Michelle to make sure that we could add it as an addendum because we wouldn't have these ready until after the agenda closes. And so as long as Michelle, the mayor, says it's okay to put it on, we can put it on.
Okay.
From a timing standpoint, it wouldn't affect...
It saves us almost 2 months,
yeah.
That's why.
It wouldn't affect the Planning Board because it wouldn't be going to the Planning Board until October at the earliest, but it would give you the ability to have the Finance Committee review the DA a little bit sooner.
Madam Chair, can I make a recommendation? I really think we should get the DA approved before we do anything else. It's possible we bring it to the full commission and we don't get this agreement approved. So it's referring it to land use and finance without having that agreement approved.
You can't approve the agreement without finance seeing it. That's the referral we're talking about, is a referral of the development agreement to finance to review and endorse.
Why does it have to go to finance?
I believe any contractual agreement like that has to be reviewed by the finance.
Right. We refer all DAs to the finance committee as a matter of practice.
Okay, I'm not sure that has a big, okay. Not sure it has a big finance component, but you know, you have your procedures. And I think it's two readings we need for the development agreement, right? Chapter 163?
By the city commission, right.
Okay, so it's going to be a while.
Right. Well,
that's why we're trying to put it for next week, so then it will be on the next finance agenda meeting, which would be in September.
Yes.
And then from finance, then it would go to commission with a recommendation from there.
Possibly do that all in September.
Can I ask a question? Is there... Because, the reason we're having so much scheduling discussion here is because of August recess, which is just lost time. Is the development agreement written? Has staff seen a draft of it?
Yeah.
So
we have negotiated.
Is it possible that we could put it in front of the Finance Committee on July 31st for review and discussion? Is that even possible?
Well, the DA's drafted. The only changes we would need to make are to the LDRs to incorporate the parking comments today. If we could do that.
That's easy, though.
Yeah,
that wouldn't be heard by finance next week. That would be for planning board at some point in the fall. So if there's no changes to the DA, I guess the question is, could this be placed on the 31st agenda, basically for a first reading, without a referral to finance?
Mr. Earle is the chair of finance, so he would be the one to...
The meeting on the 31st is a finance committee meeting.
Right.
So does it even have to go to Michelle?
We also have a commission item.
The commission meeting starts at 11. The finance committee, I believe, starts at 8. I guess the question is, can land use send something to the finance committee on its own without going to the full commission?
The commission should refer the item to finance.
That's how it's been done in the past.
Right.
But as chair of finance, can I put this on?
Technically not without a commission referral.
See how hard it is to go fast. It's very hard to go fast.
You can't ratify it after, Nick?
I don't think so. But the way to solve the problem may be to take a look at the code and see if the DA needs to go to the finance committee at all, and if the land use committee is willing to include that in its vote today, Tom and I can look at the code and see if for this specific agreement. I mean, this isn't like other development agreements where there's any city development involved or change of money necessarily. So
right.
So if the committee's okay with that, we can look at the code and see if it's absolutely
and
required.
And taking that a step further, if the code does not require finance committee review, we could put it on the agenda for first reading, and if the commission wanted to send it to finance between first and second reading, they could do that.
Okay.
That's true, Tom.
The mayor's chief of staff is here. She was watching upstairs as she exits, and she said, however, they're supportive.
Okay.
However, we can do this. I mean, the direction of this thing we all embrace, and I haven't heard from a single party that doesn't embrace the direction of it. We just want to make sure that the details are sweated out properly, and are agreeable to all parties. And we want to do that expediently because here we are.
Yeah, the document is ready. It's been reviewed by city attorney, by staff, by us. It's ready.
We can put the development agreement for commission discussion and approval for next week, for Wednesday. At the finance meeting, we can just have a hearing on it with no vote, right? We can just listen to it, and then we can have 2 hours after finance, we have a full commission meeting.
Right. So if we could have the finance committee look at it, we could put an item on commission now that's for discussion and possible action for the afternoon meeting. We could do that separate from that. Doesn't have to come back from finance. We can do that now. I mean, Commissioner Ayola.
What I would recommend, if you allow me, is let me take a look at the code and see if finance committee review is even required for this one. This is an outlier, and
okay.
If it's not, then what we can do is you could have first reading of the DA in September, unless you want to take it to finance.
Or unless I think you want to have first reading next week, July 31,
yeah,
and then second reading in September.
Yeah.
They wanted first reading. If finance review is not required, what they'd like to do is put it on for first reading next Wednesday, the 31st.
Another thing, this is, the oddity is that finance is going before the commission meeting. I mean, another thing we could do, when we can notice, you know, a finance meeting at 8, we could adjourn the commission meeting for 5 minutes, convene the finance meeting at 11:05, hear it, and then go back to full commission.
I have to tell you, I would be That's the first clever. Time we've done first reading of a DA with the city attorney out of town, so I would prefer to do first reading in September. I think there may be a way out of the finance committee review if that helps expedite, which is what the committee's looking to do. But I would be hesitant to put the DA on for first reading on July 31st. I would not recommend that.
I just had one question. Would that mean that the designation would also track with that? Because I thought that's what you were saying, they would happen at the same time.
The way the DA is structured, Daniel, is that the if the commission adopts the code amendments, which include the allowances that the owner is requesting, then following that point is when the designation ordinances would be transmitted to the planning board and city commission. So
and
the designation would
it
follow.
It wouldn't affect the zoning in progress, and none of the benefits of the LDRs or the DA could be realized until the designation is approved by the commission.
Oh, okay.
It all works together. If they didn't designate for whatever reason, the DA and the LDR changes
invalid.
For all practicable purposes go away.
So
okay, so where are we?
We're saying...
Sounds like September.
September?
First reading?
So we'll take a look. If there's no finance committee review required, then we can have first reading of the DA in September.
Okay.
So if finance committee is required, we'll have a C4 on the July 31st meeting to refer to finance.
All right. Let's defer to our city attorney. If you think best not to do that without our city attorney present, we'll have to... I want to defer to you, and we'll just listen to it in September.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And by acclamation. Are you good? Okay. Terrific. Do we want to go to the Tatum? I know that we had someone here that had to leave that was here for the Tatum, which is item 14. My agenda actually doesn't have it. So
that was added by the commission, and so we had to fast-track it as a verbal. I don't know if Neeson is still here. Neeson did address the planning board yesterday. It was a very brief discussion, and the planning board asked to continue it to their September meeting so they could put it on as a regular agenda, and they would have a full board because there was only 3 members of the board by the time they got to that item.
Well, why don't we carry it over to the next land use meeting, mm-hmm. And then in the interim, just meet with the interested parties, and you can report back because you'll have over a month and a half. See if there's any traction.
All right. By acclamation?
Okay.
Okay. Who's here for another?
Item 7 and 8.
Item 7 and 8?
We can do them together.
Item 2?
Item 2?
Okay.
I'm good.
We can do that one. All right. Item 2 is a discussion ordinance amendment pertaining minimum hotel unit size requirements for ground floor additions to contributing buildings within the MXE district.
Okay, Madam Chair, this is a proposed ordinance that would extend the ability to be able to have smaller unit sizes for additions to buildings in the MXE district. Currently, existing buildings in the MXE district have a minimum hotel unit size of 200 feet. However, if you do an addition, whether it's a rooftop addition or a ground level addition, they have to meet the minimum and average unit sizes, which is between 300 and 335 feet for new hotel units. There's actually an ordinance that will be coming to the planning board in September that would allow for these smaller units on rooftop additions. The proposal herein would extend the same allowance for ground-level additions. Staff is supportive of the proposed change. If the Land Use Committee endorses this, we can bring a referral item back to the commission in September for referral to the planning board.
Okay. Are you here to speak on this?
Good afternoon. For the record, Alfredo Gonzalez, Officer 333 Avenue America with Greenberg Traurig. I'm here on behalf of Blue Road Group in support of this ordinance. This ordinance is similar to what this commission and the committee approved for Collins Park, where you had a collection of hotels that you're allowed 200 square feet. I know in the past, Washington Avenue also has an ordinance already been enacted that allows smaller hotel rooms. These hotels in the MXC district are usually the smaller properties, and when you're doing an addition, including a rooftop addition, you want to be able to match the sizes that are in the historic building. And at least for the Blue Road Group that controls about 14, 15 properties within South Beach, for example, within the MXC, they own the Aqua Hotel at 1550 Collins, and they're looking at doing a redevelopment where in the rear they'll add hotel rooms and maybe a one-story addition. For them, a 200 square feet is their typical room size that they look at, slightly larger depending on the configuration. They're working on a site in the Collins Park that will allow a minimum of 200. They're proposing 226 because that's what fits in that site and for the type of rooms that they need. They typically do like a three-star hotel, and their clienteles are usually one to two occupants in a hotel room that come without cars, and they really want looking for a clean hotel room to stay at. They're not looking for that luxury product that may be a five or six with much larger hotel rooms. So we ask you to support the ordinance. Thank you.
Anyone else from the public to speak on this item? No? Any thoughts?
I support it.
Yeah, I support it. Historic hotels already have like 200 square feet, 230, 250, so I don't see any objection.
Okay. All right then, Tom. So what do we need? You said we need a referral to the planning board?
Yeah, so this will need to go back to the city commission as a C4 item for a referral to the planning board.
Okay. By acclamation. By acclamation. Now, that one, we're not trying to accelerate, I don't think, right? So we'll just put that on its regular track.
Yeah, this will go to the planning. This will go to the city commission in September for referral to the planning board. Now, if we get it to the planning board in September, it wouldn't come back to the commission for first reading until October. So unless we did it as two readings in October, we may need to seek a different sponsor, because if second reading follows a normal track, that would take second reading in December.
Okay. All right. So that's
so that's something, depending on how this moves, if we can do two readings in October, we can do that. But if not, then we'll just have to seek a different sponsor.
Okay. Well, and I'm welcome, Alfredo, if you want to approach someone else who's off cycle to co-sponsor with me, that's fine.
And I'll work on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll co-sponsor.
Okay. Terrific. All right, Commissioner Ariely, you said...
We can do 7 and 8.
Is there anyone here for... Oh,
Bruce, I think...
Yep, okay, so let's do
item 7 first. I can kind of even put them together. I just want to put them out into the public sphere and get your thoughts, staff's...
Let me just say what they are. Item 7 is discuss limiting big box formula retail and formula restaurants in Sunset Harbor. Item 8 is the same, discuss limiting big box formula retail and formula restaurants on Lincoln Road. So 7 is Sunset Harbor, 8 is Lincoln Road.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Sort of related, I'm just trying to time my comments because Commissioner Malakoff, I think, is going to come out of the bathroom. I want to get her thoughts on this. So with respect to Lincoln Road and Sunset Harbor, you know, I've got concerns about certain types of retail establishments in Sunset Harbor and Lincoln Road that I think don't really jive with the overall sort of aesthetics and resident and tourist experiences on those in those neighborhoods. Specifically, I'll talk to you about Sunset Harbor. One of my big concerns is, you know, I'm seeing rising rents. I'm seeing, you know, more storefronts going vacant, and they're still building product. And I worry that landlords will start to seek to fill in those vacant storefronts with, for example, fast food establishments. And right now we don't have any prohibition. And it creates a domino effect, in my opinion, and I've researched this a lot and talked to a lot of experts. Like, once you start getting, whether it's a Pizza Hut, I don't want to name names because that's not fair, but, you know, you start getting these certain types of retail establishments, it starts crowding out other potential tenants, and I think the character of the neighborhood starts to change. You know, I think we've seen it in places like Washington Avenue, for example, that, you know, at one time was, you know, a very vibrant commercial corridor for us with a lot of unique restaurants and shops. And then, you know, they've all been replaced by whether it's tattoo parlors or fast food joints and what have you. And I, for one, like to I live in Sunset Harbor, and I like to preserve the character of that neighborhood. But similarly, along Lincoln Road, too. We've seen Lincoln Road become an outpost for really large national retail chains, crowd out the mom and pops. Right now, we don't have any prohibition. We recently saw Walgreens almost come to Lincoln Road, and the outpouring from residents and other businesses on Lincoln Road against their opening. So really, today for our own discussion, there's only two of us here, is, you know, what approach do we want to take towards Lincoln Road with respect to formula restaurants, big box retail, and then in Sunset Harbor, where I have a very specific viewpoint, particularly around formula restaurants, you know, do we have an appetite for restrictions around those?
Okay. Did you want to speak on this item?
Bruce Backman, 1800 Sunset Harbor Drive. I sent notice out to the Neighborhood Association to the buildings, but in summer had very little response, so I have nothing really to say on behalf of anyone other than myself. I just really wanted to hear the fleshed out, like, what specifically type of businesses you wanted to ban, because someone did approach me. He said, well, I can understand a typical drive-through fast food restaurant that wanted to ban it, or some giant big box discount store. Of course, we do have Office Max, and they haven't been a problem. And then someone mentioned to me, well, what happened if the Capital Grille wanted to open up? Because they're a chain restaurant, but they're obviously very high-end. I think the idea of trying to preserve the kind of unique atmosphere is really commendable. I personally like the idea. I can't speak of anyone on behalf of anyone because I just don't know. So just flesh out what type of business is yours.
It's just a discussion item, Bruce. Let's do this, Bruce, and I agree with you. It's summertime. Why don't we convene a meeting of our neighborhood in September and have just a little town hall on this topic and gauge the temperature of our neighbors? I've definitely got a clear viewpoint. I mean, particularly fast food restaurants, I don't think is compatible with our neighborhood in Sunset Harbor. You know, there are certain formula restaurants that would work, and we could look to the legislation we crafted on Ocean Drive, where we've already done this. It's restrictive but accommodating as well. And I think the threshold was like 60 stores is the threshold, and no more than 5 similar branded restaurants within Miami Beach. So it still allows landlords to find suitable tenants, but without having a Subway and a Pizza Hut in your neighborhood. And I hate
to say
negative
these?
Things about good companies, but the truth is it just changes the character of a neighborhood when they come in.
Right, where you're striving for more of a boutique
Right. Sort
of neighborhood. I'm open-minded about it. I like the direction. So do you want to open and continue this?
Open and continue.
And then we'll talk about it in September, and that'll give all the...
And with respect to Lincoln Road, I know the Lincoln Road bid has been working on this as well. They're generally in favor of some kind of legislation, but they want to figure out how to do it so that you balance the interests of landlords and residents, because there's a lot of really good big box retailers on Lincoln Road. But, you know, Lincoln Road's different because that's a holistic thing. You need a combination of anchors that bring people to support the mom and pops. But Sunset Harbor is a neighborhood. It's really a resident local economy. And so, you know, how do we treat that?
I appreciate what you're doing, because it's much better for the community to put the framework that you want in place rather than try to clean it up after you observe somebody come in that you didn't want to see. That puts the city in a bad position. Yeah. So,
with respect to Sunset Harbor, there is some urgency. So I'll take it up in September, because there are storefronts that are vacant now and there's no restrictions. And I know landlords are having a tough time filling them. So, you know, what would happen if you get Buffalo Wild Wings coming in? There'd be no protection.
Okay. All right. Quickly, we have two more items. Let's jump to item 10.
And can I just confirm something real quick on the previous item, item 2, regarding the hotel unit sizes? Commissioner Arreola, you said you would agree to co-sponsor that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom, you want to set us up for item 10?
Sure. Item 10 is a proposal to consider a conditional use amendment for the 600 block of Washington Avenue. And this would basically, the ordinance which was drafted by the proposer would basically allow for, in the RM2 district, which currently prohibits neighborhood impact establishments and prohibits entertainment establishments, it would allow within this area of Washington Avenue, which is surrounded by commercial districts, to go to the planning board for conditional use approval for restaurants, right, cafes, eating and dining establishments, which include entertainment as an accessory use to a hotel. And this may also include establishments that qualify as an NIE. This is something that staff is supportive of. It was a referral to land use only, so if the land use committee is supportive of it, this would have to go back to the this was a dual referral. So if the land use committee is supportive of this, we can take this to the planning board at their September meeting.
You're supportive. I am too, and actually Commissioner Malikoff, I showed it to her before she left, and she was supportive as well. So to me, this is like the opposite of spot zoning. It's unspot zoning in a way that this little parcel was left out. And the planning board will still scrutinize all CUPs. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to add? It looks like you can only make it worse because we agree with you.
I have nothing else to add.
All right. Then by acclamation, supportive position from the Land Use Committee, and we'll hear what the Planning Board has to say, which means that if the Planning Board, are they?
Yeah, this is another. They had their meeting yesterday, so we'll take it to the Planning Board at their September meeting, which means that it'll come back to the full City Commission
in October.
In October, which means we may run into the same situation with regard to if the adoption is in December.
Commissioner Ariola has also volunteered to co-sponsor this one, just in case.
Okay.
Just in case. All right. That leaves us with last item. Item 4, report on the matrix work plan. That is our last item. Am I correct about that?
Yes. This is the last item. Okay. This item, from a time standpoint, do you have a few minutes for me to go over this? Okay. As the committee will recall, the matrix group was retained late last year to provide a very comprehensive overview of our land development and permitting processes. And through a number of stakeholder interviews, both external stakeholders and internal stakeholders, they came up with a series of recommendations that were presented to the City Commission in June. The City Commission endorsed the recommendations, and as part of endorsing the recommendations, they referred two items to the Land Use and Development Committee and did a dual referral to the Land Use and Development Committee and the Planning Board. The first was to the Land Use Committee to maintain as a standing discussion item the workflow or the work plan, and we have a chart that summarizes the progress of the work plan, what's been accomplished, what hasn't been accomplished. The other thing that was referred that was a dual referral to both the Land Use Committee and to the Planning Board were three separate ordinance amendments pertaining to ways that we could reduce applications having to go to DRB and also to minimize the amount of staff time that is being spent on reviewing development applications. So there are three draft ordinances, and they're very much in draft form because they don't include titles or whereas clauses, but they're basically the text of the ordinances. The first would be a simplification of the single-family development regulations. And this is being done not just to simplify staff review, but also to simplify architect review and property owners' understanding of the ordinance. What we've found over the years is that our single-family development regulations are so complicated that it's become challenging not just for homeowners and architects to understand, but it's challenging for staff to review it. And we believe that you can still get the same quality of home with simplified regulations. And so we've developed modifications to these regulations to achieve that end. The second is the pre-42 single-family home regulations. In order to reduce the number of applications that are going to the DRB, the proposal herein would be to allow the staff review of replacement homes, homes that are replacing pre-42 architecturally significant single-family homes to be reviewed administratively if the new replacement home is less than 25% lot coverage and less than 40% unit size. Currently, if you're replacing a new pre-42 single-family home, the new home has to go to DRB regardless of what the size of the new home is. What we think this will do is, one, it will reduce the number of applications that go to the DRB and allow more staff, more review authority. But two, and more importantly, it will encourage people to consider replacing the pre-42 home with a smaller home. Because if they're going to go with the larger maxed out home, they would still have to go to the DRB. But if they're willing to go with something smaller that's more consistent with the original home, it could be reviewed at staff level. And then the last one is increased administrative authority for commercial and multifamily projects outside of historic districts, and that would amend, that's a small amendment to the DRB section of the code, which would give staff greater authority for additions to existing buildings outside of historic districts. The last thing that we have in the memo is with regard to notice requirements, and that was one of the things that the Matrix group talked about at length was our notice process. Right now, all of our land use boards have a minimum 30-day notice requirement, which includes posting, it includes mail notice, and it includes a published notice. And so one of the things that the Matrix group talked about was perhaps reducing that. And so we came up with two options. One would be an across-the-board reduction from 30 days to 15 days for all land use boards, maintaining the current requirements for noticing of published, posting, and mail notice, but rather than having it be a 30-day notice, it would be a 15-day notice. The second option, which goes a little bit further, would be to reduce the notice requirements to the minimum required by state law, which I believe is simply a 10-day notice, 10-day published notice. So that would eliminate the mail notice requirement, and it would reduce the time frame that all these projects have to be noticed via published notice to 10 days. So we didn't draw up an ordinance for either one of those. That's a pretty simple ordinance change, but we first wanted to bring that one item to you to get your policy direction on that.
Okay, sounds good. Hello.
Hi, yes, Daniel Serrato, Miami Design Preservation League. So when the Matrix plan was done and the recommendations were made, I know because, you know, I come to the land use meetings and I didn't really hear the discussion about the pre-42 changing the review process. As you all know, the single-family home demolitions, the McMansions issue is something that has been ongoing. There's sort of been this compromise in place for several years about sort of what you could build, what's reviewed, what's not, and it seems to be working. And so that's why when I saw this referral to basically make it that if you're knocking down a pre-42 home, you don't have to go to the design review board. You don't have to, you know, talk to your neighbors, et cetera. It seems like this would kind of change a balance. And so rather than, like right now, we do see homes being renovated, pre-42 homes. We see, let's say, not very nice homes being knocked down and rebuilt. But so there is kind of this incentive framework in place as it is. So I would worry about changing the process to not require the pre-42 home review without a lot of public, you know, input. As you know, like it was like 1 or 2 years last time the single family homes were reviewed, and I haven't heard a ton of public, you know, coming and saying, oh my God, we have to remove the DRB process, we have to change all the zoning. So I mean, I'll follow up with the staff about kind of who was interviewed, but I would say, I'm assuming, are these land use, do these require 5/7s? Maybe as far as prioritization, like honestly, there was one I saw I think everyone would love, which is simplifying how often zoning changes come to the land use. I think that would simplify a lot of our lives and not have, you know, every land use be very long.
What would you do?
I know, I'd have nothing
You'd
else
have
to do.
You'd have to get a hobby.
Right. But so I don't know, maybe like there's a way the commission could prioritize rather than, you know, and I saw the staff had this very robust change of single family zoning. It seems like they had spent many, many hours on, you know, and maybe there may have been other things that we talked about today that they could have been more of a priority. So I would just urge that you know, we don't rush with this pre-42, because I know that, you know, there's no one here now, but if it does come out that we're going to kind of remove that DRB process, you know, and it has served us well. I think that the DRB does good work. They have architects. Just even the public process of talking to your neighbors is nice. So when people go to the Hamptons for the summer and they come back, there isn't a construction site next door without maybe they know a little bit about that. I would just urge it. We hold off on that in the summer and maybe come back to review it, you know, when there's a little more time.
Thank you.
And yeah. I just need to clarify one thing. Per what Daniel said, we're not removing the DRB process in its entirety. It would only apply if you're going over the thresholds. So if people were willing to build a smaller home, they wouldn't have to go. But if they're going over either 25% lot coverage or 40% unit size, even if they did it as a future addition, then at that point it would require DRB approval. Also, the Matrix Group didn't recommend this. What the Matrix Group recommended was a much broader look at what we could do to reduce DRB applications and expand administrative authority. These are the three options that staff came up with. The right. Matrix Group was
in charge.
They
gave you the call to action. You studied that call to action and where you thought you could most effectively apply it. And
correct.
This is what you're coming back with.
Yeah. Okay. Now, these three proposals, they weren't part of the referral that the commission made in June. Right. We had recommended a dual referral. So for transparency purposes, if this committee is favorably disposed, perhaps you want to send it back to the commission for referral so the commission understands exactly what's being referred to the planning board. Mm-hmm. They would still have to come back to the commission for first reading, and that's a 5-7 vote.
Right.
But since these were drafted after the referral, the commissioners did not see what was actually being dual referred.
Yeah, I see both sides of this because I agree with Daniel that, you know, we were very worried and very intentionally addressed, like, that McMansion phenomenon. We increased the setbacks and we reduced lot coverage and we made a whole bunch of edits. I think it was 2015 or so. That we really modified all of that. That's not changing in here. We're not going back on any of that. At the same time, we have this, like I said, a call to action for the city to be more efficient and easier to do business with. And that's why we hired Matrix to help us figure out where to apply that philosophy. I read the demolition of pre-42 single-family home regulations as you described it, that you set a threshold where if the new structure was going to cover less than 25% of the lot, that's pretty small, and less than 40% of the unit size, again, that it was an incentive, really, for smaller homes, and you were building that and saying, as long as you're building a small home, then your incentive is you can avoid that board review, which is, you know, takes time and money. I mean, I think that's a good conversation. I'm not necessarily endorsing it. I think it does deserve public scrutiny and everybody to get comfortable with it. And it's goodness, but we don't need to rush it because we don't want to leave anybody behind. I agree with that. So that's on the demolition. The other is the notice. I think going all the way to the state law requirement of the 10 days and only mail notice, maybe too big of a leap from where we are now. As long as we keep the notice requirements, I do think that the city of Miami Beach government is probably more transparent than any other government I've ever been associated with, but possibly 30 to 15 days notice, or maybe 30 to 20. I think we could exercise that. I'm in favor of, I'd like to hear from the planning board where they would really chew on all these details. I appreciate the study by the planning department to try to implement efficiencies. I think they're worthy of discussion. We'll see if they all survive, you know, the test of scrutiny. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
All right. So Let's do that. Let's go ahead and have you take those to the planning board. It's a high hurdle. At the end, when they come back to commission, they have to get five votes. So let's start the process. Let's work on them, chew on them at the proper boards. And at the end of that, you know, it's a super majority that they have to cross. Yes. So
would this include outreach to all the HOAs as part of it? You know, like Pine Tree Drive and... Because, you know, you mentioned...
Would MDPL like to host, like, a workshop to discuss them?
I mean, it's sort of a city, right? It's a city initiative, so...
Yeah, no, of course, but right, like, but it's a little bit excessive to send staff to every single HONA in the city, so that's a little bit excessive.
Well, I'm the legislation on the planning board agenda would be noticed on our website and in the newspaper as we do all planning board agendas, so notice would be provided.
Mm-hmm. So when would this go to planning
board? So this would go to planning board on September 24th, and then we would bring it back to City Commission for first reading in October. On October 16th, the Commission would decide, basically hearing what the Planning Board's input is, getting the input from Land Use today. They would decide which ones, if any, they want to move forward with. It's a 5/7 vote, and it would be first reading. And so if there's not five votes at first reading, then those are the ones that wouldn't be able to move forward.
So would this be... transmitted to planning board at the next commission on the consent agenda?
This was a dual referral at the June meeting. But then, so
you know, we could do, Tom. We do have that new relatively new thing on the city's website where homeowners associations are registering. I mean, we could do a special notice to any HOA that has registered with the city.
Sure. Yeah, we could advise them of the September planning board meeting.
But as of now, this just goes directly from land use to planning board.
Yes.
Is that correct?
It was a dual referral.
Yeah.
Even though there was nothing in the title of what the specific ordinance was.
They were ordinances to address the recommendations of the land use of the matrix group, and it was a dual referral of those ordinances to the land use committee and to the planning board.
Okay.
I mean, personally, I'm not worried because it's going to go to planning board. It's going to get really chewed on there. And that's in
September.
So then it would come back, you know, if planning board, whatever planning board recommends, would come back to October commission. And, you know, if it's too accelerated for what we're ready for, I mean, there's plenty of time to talk about it. So, okay. I mean, I'm not worried. But I do think it's not a bad idea. And I want to find reasons to encourage homeowners associations to register with the city and be a part of that registration. So this is one of those advantages. If you do register, then when things come up like this, we know who they are and we can communicate explicitly with them, which is good. That adds to our transparent government.
And Madam Chair, if I may, just to be fair, that when the report was accepted by commission and the referrals made, it did have our work plan, where we indicated things we were doing administratively or legislatively. Mm-hmm. And 22 specifically says modify approval authority for single-family homes constructed pre-42, not located in historic districts.
Okay,
staff should have the authority to review and approve these. And the other one was conduct a review of project types to identify more projects that can be approved at the staff level without board review. Single-family residents in particular should be fast-tracked. So then Tom's staff worked on the ordinances based on those two recommendations.
Okay.
In the work plan.
Right, and I spoke to a couple of commissioners about it, and they just didn't quite understand that the simple language. But, you know, if you want to bring it to planning and, you know, spend all that time, then we'll see at the commission if it gets filed.
Okay, by acclamation then, yeah.
Madam.
What the committee would recommend is on the notice, rather than going with a more aggressive, just state minimum state requirement, take our existing notices and go from 30 to 15.
Correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I – I just have one comment on the International Inn. I wanted to take a look at the code and see if there was any way to expedite. I confirm that there is no Finance Committee review required, but unfortunately, because the development agreement statute requires 7-day mail and newspaper notice, we would have to do the first reading in September anyway. But we could still do first and second reading, you know, between September and October.
Okay. Great.
In September – we finalize the budget and everything, so I think we have multiple meetings in September, so we might actually be able to do both.
We may even be able to do both. Yeah, we'll take a look at the dates.
All right, terrific. Well, then, if there's nothing else, this concludes the July 24th Land Use and Development Committee meeting.
Good job.